Good Friday to you. Thank you so much for tuning in to another edition of NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by our friends at Nosler. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Cam Edwards, your host, glad that you're with us today. We have a great show for you. Ed Morrissey from Hot Air is going to join us a little bit later on in the hour, talking about some of the big stories of the day and the week. Also, Andrew Langer from the Institute for Liberty, who is making his way up towards New Hampshire and the primary there next week. We'll also talk with Andrew about the latest on Operation Choke Point. Coming up in hour two, Sheriff David Clark from Milwaukee County, Wisconsin, on efforts to get armed citizens their firearms returned to them. You know, oftentimes when a defensive gun use is being investigated, the firearm will be seized during the investigation. But after that has been ruled a case of self-defense, it shouldn't be an issue for that law-abiding gun owner to have that firearm returned to them. But you'd be amazed at how difficult it can be sometimes to get the firearm back in the rightful hands of its owner. Scott Olmstead from NRA's American Hunter on an issue that has been slowly percolating out in California, the changing of the guard at the Fish and Game Commission. And you have more and more appointees who are less and less friendly to hunting and fishing and activities like that. And instead, you have some anti-hunting voices that are being raised here. I actually had a resignation there at the Fish and Game Commission out in California over this very issue. So we'll talk with Scott Olmstead about it coming up next hour. In hour three, our hero of the day, sponsored by AdCorps Defense, our deal of the day, our good guy of the day, plus Charles Cook of National Review. On the gun sales numbers, we mentioned this on yesterday's program, or maybe it was the day before yesterday. January of 2016, setting a January record for NICS sales. Now, month to month, it was down a little bit from December, which might be expected with the holiday shopping season over, but still over 2.5 million NICS checks. Charles on Twitter yesterday was talking about the estimates would be then in the upper range that Americans would own somewhere around 400 million firearms. Now, violent crime, again, continues to drop in this country. 40-year lows. FBI did say there was a 1.5% increase in violent crime in the first 6 months of 2015, largely attributable to the rise in violent crime in a few U.S. cities. But you still have the anti-gun mantra that more guns equals more crime. That none of what we have seen over the past 20 years should have happened. As more Americans became gun owners, more Americans became concealed carry holders, more Americans exercised their Second Amendment rights, more and more privately owned firearms were in the hands of Americans. Violent crime should not have dropped. But it did. And again, we're not talking about a 1 or 2 year statistical blip. We are talking about a dramatic drop in violent crime. So we'll talk about it with Charles Cook coming up in hour three. Also, our friend Tony Katz, host of Tony Katz of the Morning News on WIBC in Indianapolis, Indiana. We'll talk about his trip to Iowa for the caucuses there. Had a big weekend in Iowa. We'll also talk about some of the big stories of the week. As a matter of fact, let's take a look at a couple of stories. You know, yesterday on the program, we were discussing the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals decision in the Colby case, Colby versus Hogan. This is the Fourth Circuit's decision to say that the state's gun control laws, including the Firearm Safety Act, need to be considered through the lens of strict scrutiny, the highest measure of judicial review, and they sent this case back down to the lower court saying, please do so because you didn't do it the first time. In this court decision, Gabriel Mellor has a piece at National Review on strict scrutiny for firearms restrictions. Gabe, an attorney there in the D.C. area, and he says, for the first time, a federal appeals court has held that a state's ban on, quote-unquote, assault long guns and, quote-unquote, high-capacity magazines must be held to the highest level of judicial scrutiny. In a 2-1 decision, the Circuit Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit, which covers Maryland, North Carolina, South Carolina, Virginia, and West Virginia, held that Maryland's Fire and Safety Act must be evaluated under that same stringent standard that courts routinely use to strike down race-based governmental discrimination, categorical bans on speech. Since, like them, Gabe says, the law seeks to restrict a core constitutional freedom. The appeals sent the law back to district court to give Maryland a chance to muster evidence in defense of barring law-abiding citizens from possessing long guns. In other words, the Second Amendment, the right of the people to keep and bear arms, must be treated under the law no differently, no less important than the right of the people to speak freely, than the right of the people to use the press, the right of the people to peaceably assemble. It is just as real a right as our First Amendment rights, and it needs to be treated as such. That's what the Fourth Circuit said yesterday, particularly in regards to the Maryland Firearm Safety Act. Remember, the court asked, all right, so is this a Second Amendment case? Yes, it's a Second Amendment case. Are the guns in question, do they fall under Second Amendment protection? Yes, they do, the court said. These are firearms that are in common use, owned by many millions of law-abiding Americans for a variety of lawful purposes. Yes, these firearms are protected by the Second Amendment. Yes, these magazines, which are a required part of that firearm. We can't really use the firearm without the magazine. Yes, these are also instruments that fall under the protection of the right to keep and bear arms. And the court laid out their arguments as to why this was a Second Amendment case, why these firearms actually and magazines fell under the purview of the Second Amendment. And then and only then did they talk about the level of review that should be used when they look at these laws. Now, Gabe says, to the uninitiated, this may all seem like a meaningless exercise in linguistic hair splitting. And yet, he says, the level of scrutiny that courts apply to a given law determines something important, namely the degree to which the government is permitted to regulate the realm in which that law is binding. Strict scrutiny, which is reserved for laws or regulations that infringe upon core rights, puts the burden on the government to show that its restrictions on constitutionally protected conduct are narrowly tailored to achieve a compelling governmental interest. Now, again, this was the argument by the Attorney General of Maryland. Well, these guns are really dangerous. They're unusual and they're dangerous. And so they don't even fall under the protections of the Second Amendment. The court rejected that argument. The state was arguing for a standard of not reasonableness, but that sort of vague, fuzzy middle ground where you don't have to show that this is the most narrowly applied restriction to achieve a compelling governmental interest. Instead, you simply have to show that there's some reasonable basis to conclude that there is a relationship between the law in question and the governmental interest, in this case, public safety. You just have to reasonably assume. And again, that's a very big, broad, vague middle ground. A lot of gun control laws are upheld under intermediate scrutiny. At National Review, Gabe says that, again, this is the first time that a circuit court has said, yes, these are firearms that are protected under the Second Amendment. Yes, these magazines are protected under the Second Amendment. And yes, intermediate scrutiny is not the the bar here. The bar is higher because we're talking about a core right. Now, Gabe does say, unfortunately, and he points out correctly, it's too early to say that Maryland's gun ban has been declared unconstitutional. Before that happens, Gabe says, Maryland will have an opportunity to show the district court that the ban passes strict scrutiny. But he says it's not too early to say that Maryland needlessly drove away 300 manufacturing jobs when it passed its probably unconstitutional gun law. Yeah. And he says Maryland, for obvious reasons, is not eager to take up the challenge of showing that a categorical gun ban is narrowly tailored to prevent crime, but not such lawful gun use as self-defense, hunting, and target shooting. He says the state's already announced that it'll seek further review of this decision, either by asking the Fourth Circuit to rehear the case en banc before all of the judges within the Fourth Circuit, as opposed to a three-judge panel, or by petitioning the Supreme Court to resolve the issue. As Gabe points out, last year the Supreme Court declined to take up a Seventh Circuit case that let stand Chicago's ban on semi-automatic long guns and magazines over 10 rounds, but a circuit split of this sort is one of the things that is likely to lead to the high courts accepting a case. Gun rights activists, he says, have good reason to be excited about this decision. And I think that Gabe's absolutely right here. Now, again, we don't know why the court has not taken up a Second Amendment case since the McDonald decision in 2010. We do know it takes four justices to agree to hear a case. Remember, it takes five to get a majority win. So it doesn't look like there are four justices who either think it's a slam dunk win or a slam dunk loss on either side to take one of these Second Amendment cases that has come before the court. But Gabe is correct that one of the things that makes it more likely, doesn't make it a lock, no guarantee, but one of the things that makes it more likely that the court will hear a case is if there is a split within the circuits. If the Fourth Circuit says that banning these semi-automatic rifles is a violation of the Second Amendment and the rights of Americans to exercise their Second Amendment rights, and the Seventh Circuit says no, actually, we don't think that these guns even fall under the protection of the Second Amendment. We think that as long as the public, even if they did, as long as the public believes that with a ban that they will be more safe, that's good enough. I mean, that is in essence what the Seventh Circuit said. That the state of Illinois or the city of Highland Park could pass a gun ban that would have absolutely no practical impact on the violent crime rate. But if it made people feel better, if it made people feel safer, then it could stand. It was okay. Because, again, there's a perceived public safety benefit. I suppose you'd have to poll. I mean, even if that's the standard you want to use, and I don't think it is, how do you determine this? And people's feelings change over time. You might take a poll 1 month. Maybe there haven't been any violent crimes reported in Highland Park, and people would say, yeah, I feel like this is keeping us safe. The next month, there might be a string of burglaries or a string of robberies, and you might find all of a sudden that people think this law is ridiculous. And the month after that, again, maybe it's a 50-50 split. We don't base our laws on public opinion, and yet the Seventh Circuit said, yeah, when it comes to gun control laws, it's fine to do that, even if there's no real benefit. In fact, you know, there might even be a negative impact because the court admitted, yeah, people's, you know, ability to acquire these firearms to use in self-defense might be hindered. They said it was okay, though. They could probably still find another way to exercise their right to keep and bear arms for self-defense, even with a gun ban like this in question. But even if this ban proves to be a hindrance to the public safety and individual safety of some of the residents there, it's okay because other people might feel safer. Well, the Fourth Circuit did not go along with that line of thinking. And the dissenting judge was very angry about that in the 2-1 decision. But as the chief judge for the Fourth Circuit, Judge Baxley, I believe, wrote in his opinion, look, we're not a rubber stamp for other circuits. And it doesn't matter that we're the First Circuit to say, hey, you know what? The Second Amendment really is a real right. And, yeah, the semi-automatic rifles, they're pretty common in this country. A lot of Americans own them. Most of them aren't criminals. The vast majority of these firearms that are sold will never be used in a violent crime. They'll be used for hunting, target shooting, self-defense. But they won't be used for a crime. And the judge said, it's not up to us to fall in line, to go along, to get along. We have to look at the facts of this case. And we have to go where the facts of this case lead us. And here, he said, the facts of this case, the words of the Supreme Court and Heller and McDonald, have made it clear that these laws actually do impact at a fundamental level, the Second Amendment rights of law-abiding residents in the state of Maryland. Now go back and look at the facts of this case, keeping that in mind. The court, again, did not say you will find these laws to be unconstitutional. The court simply, I shouldn't say simply, at the end of the day, told the trial judge, you used the wrong standard. We're talking about a real right. Treated as such. Told the state of Maryland, told the attorney general, we're treating this like it's a real right, because it is. Tailor your arguments accordingly. And they will make their arguments. Still an open question, at least at this point, as to where those next arguments will take place. Whether this decision would be appealed before an en banc review, to go to the Supreme Court, or again, send this back down to the trial court, which is what the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals said yesterday, which does start the case over again. Again, the Attorney General would be arguing on grounds of strict scrutiny. But do you want the Supreme Court to possibly hear this case if you are an anti-gun advocate? Do you want them to try to rule on the judge's decision that, yes, these firearms are protected by the Second Amendment. Yes, this involves the core right of self-defense at the heart of the right to keep and bear arms. And again, do you think it's likely that the court will rule on that? Now, again, a split does exist. But if this goes back down to trial, if the trial court were to find that, no, these laws, again, can't stand under strict scrutiny, well, that starts the whole appeals process. They'll go back up to the Fourth Circuit, and then you've got an opportunity again for an en banc review and a Supreme Court review. So we don't know where the next step is going to lead, but we do know that there will be a next step in this case. All right, we're going to take a quick time out. When we return to the program, Mr. Ed Morrissey joins us from Hot Air, talking about some of the big stories of the day and of the week. Stick around. We will be right back with more NRA News, Cam and Company.
HQ Moody with NRA Competitive Shooting Division National Rifle Manager. Welcome back to NRA News. You always have something on. What's going on now, HQ?
Nice to see you, John. Right now, we're getting ready for the National Indoor Championships, which actually shooting begins on the first weekend of January and runs through March. Right now, at this point in space, we're accepting bids for the championship. This is the single largest competitive shooting event that the NRA runs. We have somewhere around 4,300 competitors that shoot this event every year. It's huge.
It is huge. So give us an idea of the discipline, what it involves, and who competes.
Yeah, well, there's 13 championships involved in the whole thing. And it ranges for three-position conventional rifle and three-position metric, which is kind of like an international brand. We shoot two types of air rifle, sporter, precision. We also have an air rifle standing, and we have an open. And we have a junior championship. So what you take is one set of matches, double it for the juniors.
So it's a wide range of disciplines and of competitors. So who can qualify for this?
Anybody that wants to shoot it. We have, I think Diane Bullock, who runs the matches, runs some 200 and some 300 national matches, and they're all individual matches shot all over the country. When the shoulder-to-shoulder matches are shot, they send their results to Diane. She compilates all of this stuff, and then we come up with national winners.
Wow. So, the logistics that you guys go through are impressive. So how can folks get more information about this particular competition?
Sure. Get a hold of the statistical officer for the national match, Diane Bullock, D. Bullock, B-U-L-L-O-C-K, at NRAHQ.org.
All right. H.Q. Moody, NRA Competitive Shooting Division, National Rifle Manager, thanks for what you do, and thanks for being on NRA News. Again, good to see you, my friend.
You too, John.
What kind of government cares more about appeasing Islamic terrorists than defending the constitutional rights of its citizens? A government that would disarm us during the age of terror. Nothing would make us more vulnerable to generations of suffering and slaughter than the destruction of our Second Amendment. But many of our politicians, aided by a relentless media, are launching that attack themselves. They dream of joining the rest of the disarmed peoples of the world, entrusting our survival to the mercy of monsters. The greatest damage the terrorists could ever inflict upon us is disarmament at the hands of the political elites. But we will never offer our right to survive as a fool's ransom to the world's killers. Our freedom is what they fear most. I'm the National Rifle Association of America, and I'm freedom's safest place.
You critics don't define our honor. You try to shame us for doing our job. You teach children to fear us, crowds to attack us, and good people to doubt us. But we will never back down from our sworn duty to uphold the Constitution of the United States of America. We wake up every day, put on our badge, strap a gun to our hips, kiss our families goodbye, and put our lives between the law-abiding and any criminal who threatens their rights. We serve people of every color and creed, men, women, and children in violent, dangerous neighborhoods, because they have the same right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness as CEOs, movie stars, and the political elite. We are Americans. And we are the American police officer. We stand with the National Rifle Association of America, and the NRA stands with us. Together, we're freedom's safest place.
Welcome back to NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler. We are going to be broadcasting from Harrisburg, Pennsylvania on Monday from the Great American Outdoor Show. I'm really looking forward to that. I will be heading up tonight. If you're going to be there in Harrisburg over the weekend, please stop by the NRA News booth. I will be there Saturday and Sunday, and hopefully we'll get a chance to say hi and talk a little bit. Right now, I want to welcome to the program our friend Ed Morrissey from Hot Air. Ed, how are you, sir?
Good afternoon, sir.
How are things?
Things are going well, you know. I got the book coming out, and I got the website up for the book, and just clocking along. And one of my colleagues is going to be at on the moderator panel for tomorrow night's debate. So that's Mary Catherine Hamm. So, you know, life is good.
Life.
I'm with you.
You know what? I'm getting ready to go to Harrisburg for the Great American Outdoor Show. I'm going to be hanging out with thousands of NRA members and outdoorsmen and veterans, and it's going to be a good 4 or 5 days. So, yeah.
It sounds awesome. Yeah.
If you've never been to Harrisburg in February, there's no reason to go unless you're going to the Great American Outdoor Show.
That sounds like Minnesota. The only reason to go to Harrisburg would be because you're otherwise in Minnesota, you know?
Exactly. By the way, speaking of Minnesota, I tweeted out a story earlier today that concealed carry licenses skyrocketing in Minnesota, like much of the country. But I think they said in January they approved 6,000 concealed carry licenses, which was far above January of last year.
Well, I think part of that you can thank Barack Obama, the nation's greatest firearm salesman, for that boost. I saw that earlier today too. I haven't written about it, but I was one of the people who got their carry permits. I had let mine lapse because I was doing a lot of traveling last year when it was due for renewal. So I had to start over from scratch. But so I'm one of the ones that got it in January. So it doesn't surprise me. People here have. And this is a type of activism. It's a type of quiet activism, I think. The firearm purchases and the carry permits, it's not because some of it might be in response to the shooting in San Bernardino that took place in November, for instance, and the terrorist attack there, might be in response to that. That might be part of it. But I think it's an easy way to, A, exercise your Second Amendment rights, mm-hmm. to go through the training and the experience of getting a carry permit and buying a firearm legally to demonstrate that there's demand for this, that the American people stand in solidarity with Second Amendment rights and the natural right to effectively defend yourself, whether you're at home or you're away from home. And that is the type of quiet activism, I think, that ends up speaking a lot louder than sometimes pickets on the street. And it shows very clearly that even in a state as liberal as Minnesota, as it's more or less liberal right around the Twin Cities, the rest of the state is somewhat more moderate to moderate conservative. But even in a state with that type of political bent, where the last time the last Republican president to win Minnesota was Richard Nixon.
Wow.
I'm not kidding you either. It's the only state that Reagan never carried was Minnesota. And even in a state like that, Second Amendment rights are important, and they're important enough for people to go out and invest in them in the most literal way you can do it, which is to invest in a firearm, invest in a carry permit, invest in training for yourself so that you can use a firearm effectively in the rare chance that you might need to do so. I think it speaks volumes about the broad nature of support for individual Second Amendment rights.
You know, I think that you're spot on with this, Ed. And you know, it's interesting because you can look and you can see how the number of permits have grown over the years. And there's been certainly a ramping up, let's say, but over the past 5 years or so, not even over the past just year or two, you know, it's been a pretty steady increase every year of more Minnesotans getting their concealed carry license. So I don't think this is a blip. I don't think this is, we're not seeing a spike. You're just seeing a steady growth when you look at the numbers.
I think in part too, I mean, this is in Minnesota, it's been maturing for some time. You know, we've had, I've had the must-issue carry law here for, I think, 12 years now, because it was coming in just about the same time I was starting to blog, maybe just a little after, just a little bit before, so about 12 to 13 years. And I remember when this debate was going on, even though I wasn't terribly politically active in it, I remember when the debate was going on, and you had people who were opposed to the must-issue or shall-issue change to the carry permit law, saying there's going to be blood in the streets, it's going to be like the Wild West, every moron's going to have a gun, they're all going to be firing it all over the place. And nothing like that ever happened. And I think people, it took that experience maybe over a few years for people to realize, look, I mean, what we're talking about are the responsible people getting right. carry permits and having firearms and protecting themselves and their families. And to a certain extent, maybe by extension, their communities. And that's not a bad thing. And in fact, it's worked out to be a very good thing here in Minnesota. And I think it took a lot of the, I think it took a lot of the mystery out of it. You know, I think that it took a lot of the trepidation out of it for everybody else. And it's been, I think you get to a point where you have a comfort level with this, and more people are getting comfortable with it. And they're realizing that, you know, a carry permit doesn't mean that you're Superman. It doesn't mean that bullets can bounce off your chest. All it means is that you're responsible with a firearm and you know what you're doing with it and you've been trained what the proper use and the proper definition of self-defense is. And I think the more people that actually go through that, I was making this argument years ago when we were having this debate, the more people who go through that, even if they never put a pistol in a holster and carry it outside of the house, that carry permit is a great education. It's a great education because even people who are nervous about other people carrying firearms, if they go through that, they're going to realize that this isn't, you know, a junior G-man badge program at all. In fact, it's a rather sobering look at the very stark realities of having to act in self-defense and why you don't ever have to really want to be put in that situation. But if you do end up in that situation, you want to know what you're doing about it. And I think the more you demystify that, the better everybody feels.
No, I think you're right, and I think at some point as well, you know, you mentioned it's been, I think 2004, I think you're right, is when Minnesota's concealed carry law came into effect. So you've had that period of time. You all, I think, now have Minnesotans, many of them, who know somebody who's a concealed carry holder, whether it's a friend, a family member, coworker. That too, I think, goes a long way towards demystifying this. And and so the more you know, here we are 12 years later, violent crime hasn't gone up in Minnesota. The homicide rate is still really low. It's gone down, I think, since the concealed carry law was put into effect. So you're right. There hasn't been the Wild West mentality erupt that we were told would happen, because anti-gun advocates always say that that's what's going to happen when you either institute a concealed carry law or you expand that law. There's always going to be mayhem that somehow never arrives. And I think that does go a long way towards explaining why we are seeing, again, this steady expansion here. Now, listen, before we run out of time, I do want to ask you about a piece that you have at hot air right now about the Democratic debate, which I confess I'm part of the reason for the low ratings, because I didn't watch last night. Revenge of the Nerds was on, Ed. I mean, come on. I hadn't seen that movie in years. I had to watch Revenge of the Nerds.
Well, absolutely. I mean, I think you have to, whenever you get an opportunity to watch that movie, you have to watch that movie. I was watching the Nerds on stage, so, you know, I guess it's...
There you go.
One half doesn't know that.
Right. So you've got your piece at Hot Air. Will the real progressive please stand up? Because this, and I'm fascinated by what's playing out here in the Democratic side, where you've got Chris Matthews asking everybody and anybody to explain the difference between a Democrat and a socialist. Nobody really wants to. Bernie Sanders dinging Hillary Clinton last night, saying, listen, she's not a progressive. You can't be a moderate and a progressive. E.J. Dionne had a column in the Washington Post this week, writing about the Democratic primary, saying that Hillary Clinton is the candidate of slow progress. Bernie Sanders is the candidate of revolution, of quick progress. But they both want to end up in the same place. Do you agree with that, Ed?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think to a certain extent. I'm not sure that – I think that this is a bad fit for Hillary, to be honest with you, this whole I'm more progressive than – the Pope of Vermont sort of thing. It really doesn't fit her track record. Her track record is going to Goldman Sachs and delivering speeches and getting paid $600,000 or $200,000 or however, six figures, however much she got. She made a lot of money off of those guys. And I'm sorry, if you're a progressive, you probably don't do that. I don't think that there's anything wrong with that, by the way, except for the fact that she was still in and around government while she was doing it, you know, and when it wasn't her, it was her husband while she was Secretary of State. And they made $57.5 million during the 4 years that she was Secretary of State. I mean, that's an astounding amount of money. It was mostly from speaking fees and some from book sales, or, you know, book advances, while she was Secretary of State. So she's there. Secretary of State has, you know, quite a bit of authority to deal with business issues for American corporations, and I don't see how you can say I'm a progressive while you have a track record of using your access to power to score big money off of banks and financial institutions on Wall Street and in Russia and other places as well. It just, even if there's nothing illegal about it, and nobody's ever shown yet that there's been that there was anything illegal about it, although the FBI has expanded its probe into her email server to include public corruption now, and so there may have been something illegal about it. But even if there wasn't, let's just say that there wasn't. It's all a coincidence, and people just really like Bill Clinton, which is, you know, at least arguably true, and wanted him to speak in front of places, were willing to pay him $500,000 a pop to do it. It's not what you would normally consider a progressive thing to do, right? And the progressive thing to do would be to go out and put, you know, speak at Goldman Sachs from the street, yelling at the door up to the penthouses and threatening to bring the pitchforks and the torches with you. That's the type of speech that progressives give to Goldman Sachs. So I don't understand this other than just the need to say anything to get elected. It's a bad fit for Hillary. And I think it's obviously so, and that's one of the reasons why I think her credibility is sagging, her favorability is negative, and it's been negative now for a year, and people just aren't buying what it is that she's selling.
Interesting. Do you think that she would have had any more success at trying to differentiate herself from Bernie Sanders to say, look, I'm not if progressive means, again, standing outside yelling at Goldman Sachs rather than talking to the people inside about the need for reform, then no, I'm not a progressive. I mean, would that have played any better in the Democratic primary anyway?
Yeah, you know, in this cycle, maybe not. And that's the reason why she's not doing it, right? But it's actually not a bad approach, and it would have at least fit her track record. Now, having said that, she actually did try to do that in the 2007 and 8 cycle, and, you know, didn't really work out for her there either. So I think now she's decided that she's got to be, you know, the most progressive person ever and recognized as such. And, you know, this moment during the debate, and you missed this, but you may have caught the report about this. Bernie Sanders painting her as an establishment candidate, and she says, I'm running to be the first woman president, and you can't label me an establishment person. It's like, wait a minute. Establishment really has nothing to do with your gender. Establishment has to do with the fact that you've been in and around power for 23 years in Washington, and you used the Clinton Foundation to basically enrich yourself with some of the richest players in Wall Street and in around the world. That's what establishment means. And so it was just this odd moment. It's like, well, I'm a woman, so I can't be establishment. Okay.
There are these moments in the Hillary campaign where she says things and it doesn't make a whole lot of sense. Unless, again, you want to – she says, you know, it's not about her running as a woman. Until all of a sudden it is, Ed, right?
Right. No, and what's interesting is you take a look at the Quinnipiac poll that came out today, the national poll, and I don't put a lot of stock in national polls because they don't really predict state-by-state primary outcomes. But this was an amazing poll. She had lost – she was leading 61-30 on December 22nd in the same polling series in Quinnipiac, which is a pretty well-known and pretty well-respected polling firm. Well, today she's leading 44-42, so she has lost – 27 points in the gap in just 6 weeks. And you take a look at her numbers among women, and she's leading when it comes, you know, in head-to-head with Bernie Sanders. She's got a 10-point lead over Bernie Sanders among women, but it's only 48-38. And she can't even get half of the women in this sample to vote with her. So I think that the idea that she is going to somehow inspire women across the country to flock to the ballot booth to support her for president on the basis of being the first woman president is at best a questionable hypothesis, and I think more likely a complete fallacy. And Democrats looking at that really should be concerned about those numbers, because Bernie Sanders is he's an old guy, and he's at least within 10 points of Hillary Clinton with women in the Democratic Party. And when it comes to women in the Republican Party, women who are independents, it doesn't appear that pitch, oh, I'm going to be the first woman president, so all women are going to flock to my banner, is reality. I don't think it's going to work.
I think you're right. I think that, it comes off very much as do something for me, right? Make me president, and I will be historic. But the appeal, I think, on the Democratic side for Bernie Sanders is, I'm going to do for you, Ed, right? I'm going to give you a free college. You're going to get free health care. I'm going to give to you. Hillary Clinton has asked not what you can do or what I can do for you. Ask what you can do for me. You can make me president, the first female president.
I know, it's a great way of putting it, yeah.
And when you've got one candidate saying, let me give you free stuff, and another one saying, do something that'll put me in the history books, I think in the mood of this electorate, it's a no-brainer.
Yes, no, and that's part of the problem, too, and one of the things that I talk about in my book is that in order to really inspire the electorate, it has to be really about them, and it has to be about their aspirations, their hopes, and you have to know who those people are, and you have to have an organization that gets on the ground and understands what the specific issues are in each community, and that's something that Republicans didn't do after, say, the 2000 election and presidential elections. They skated by in 2004 without it, but they ended up getting blown out in 2008 and lost a winnable election, I think, in 2012, in large part because they were trying to do these sort of high you know, sort of high altitude, 30,000 foot messaging about freedom and liberty. And Barack Obama was going around, Barack Obama's organization was going around to the neighborhoods and saying, look, you know, Barack Obama wants to put some money into fixing that old bridge down on 4th Street that you guys got to cross over every day and you're worried it's going to crumble underneath your feet. That's the type of thing that people want to hear about. They don't want to hear about Barack Obama wants your vote because he wants to feel historic.
Right.
That wasn't how that was sold. The people might think that that was how it was sold. That was certainly part of the appeal of Barack Obama in 2008 and in, to some extent in 2012. But the real dynamic of that was it was all about the people on the ground who were casting the votes. And I think you hit the nail on the head here, Cam. This do it for me, do it for me, do it for me thing is a real non-starter.
Ed Morrissey, the author of the brand new book, Going Red, The 2 Million Voters Who Will Elect the Next President and How Conservatives Can Win Them, comes out April the 12th. You can pre-order now at Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com, and Penguin Random House has the website for the book up as well. Congratulations, Ed. Thank you for coming on the program, sir, and I look forward to doing this again very soon.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Ed Morrissey with us here on NRA News, Cam and Company. Andrew Langer of the Institute for Liberty, he is on his way to New Hampshire. We'll join him. Well, he'll join us, actually, right after a quick timeout. We'll talk about what's going on in New Hampshire, as well as the latest with Operation Choke Point. So stick around. We'll be right back here on NRA News, Cam and Company.
I'm speaking with Jana Waller with Skullbound TV. Jana, welcome back to NRA News. How are you?
I am doing fantastic. Thank you so much. Thanks
okay.
for having me.
So I follow you on social media,
mm-hmm.
and I always see, you know, you're out. Geez, you're everywhere. So I'm glad you had a chance to sit down and talk to us for a minute. But you use Nosler ammunition, and Nosler is our primary underwriting sponsor for NRA News Cam and Company. So I've been dying to get to sit down with you to talk a little bit about that. So tell us, how did you form this relationship with Nosler using
yeah,
their stuff?
Absolutely. Well, Jim Kinsey, my boyfriend and executive producer of Skullbound TV, he had a relationship with Nosler, previous relationship. He introduced me. I'm from the Midwest, from Wisconsin.
I couldn't tell by the accent.
I know.
You betcha.
He introduced me to Nosler about 6 years ago, and that is literally the only ammunition I have used. And for all six seasons of Skullbound TV, we're filming right now for season six, and it's just so incredibly accurate and dependable. I did a really neat episode this year. You know, Nosler was founded on one of their moose hunts gone bad years ago, the ammunition, not on Nosler ammunition, but,
right.
you know, they founded the ammunition company because they needed something more reliable after this bad encounter with a moose hunt. And I ended up drawing an incredible moose tag, went into Alaska, do it yourself, rented the horses, packed in, ended up just being blessed with a 64-inch bull moose.
Wow.
And I'll tell you, those Nosler bullets did the trick.
And I'll tell you what, Janet, whether you're shooting, hunting like you do,
mm-hmm.
shooting competitively, it, this is probably, if not outside the firearm, the most important thing to be a successful shooter.
It really is. I mean, a lot of things can go wrong, but it's so nice when you realize that, you know, especially like with a moose or an elk, they're such big animals. You need your ammunition to perform beautifully. And I got into long-range shooting about 3 years ago. I've trained with some of the best sniper champions, world champions. They all use Nosler as well. And
wow.
it just when you can take out, you know, a lot of things can grow on you. And, of course, you need to plug in all your ballistics, and you've got wind and altitude
right.
and all these things. But when you have ammo that you can count on to perform the way it's supposed to, and, you know, when it says it's, you know, their ballistics are what they say it is,
right.
it's just a beautiful thing.
It takes out one of those
yeah.
nagging variables,
yes.
whether the weather, the you know, that's so great. Speaking with Jana Waller with Skullbound TV about Nosler. So let's shift gear a little bit and talk a little bit about what's going on with Skullbound. How long have you been doing the show?
We are airing season 5
wow,
right now. It's amazing.
Cool.
I'm so blessed.
So going from when you started
mm-hmm.
to now, did you ever think that this would be happening?
I really didn't. I didn't foresee the success that it would have, and we just feel so blessed that things have come together the way they have. Our hunts have gone well. I feel even more lucky to have the platform for my personal conservation causes, because conservation is a very passionate topic to me. We always include a conservation piece on every episode, but it's also given me the platform to start taking veterans out hunting. Right. And it's been seriously some of the most fulfilling moments of my life. I took another Army veteran double amputee out this year on his first elk hunt, and he got his bull on day two, and there were tears all around. And I have to say, when I told Nosler that I was taking another Army hero out, they built him the gun. They
wow.
gave him the ammo. You know, they have been such a tremendous supporter of Skullbound TV and our veterans. And it just is one more reason I'm so proud to be partnered with them.
And it's something I've been following, too. We've had you on before with Cam a number of times talking about that. I follow it on social media. It's so great that you do that. And isn't it great to have it's a great agenda to have to begin with,
yeah.
you ask me, but to have a vehicle like this, you know.
Yeah.
Some of us are very lucky and blessed that we get to do what we do.
Right.
And to me, you're doing such great work. So,
well, it's a way to say thank you. And, you know, here I am in a woman in the greatest country in the world. I'm able to pursue my dreams, and I'm able to, you know, have a house full of guns, if you will, because of these men and women. And it's just a way to give back to them. And it's a wonderful platform to have that we don't take lightly.
Jenna Waller, how can we get more information about you? Where do we got to go?
You can go to skullboundtv.com. Super simple. We also have a lot of information on the Sportsman's Channel website, but we're on Big Game Wednesday nights. I'm happy to be a part of this industry.
Jenna Waller, thank you so much for what you're doing. Thanks for being on NRA News.
Thanks for having me.
Welcome back to NRA News, Cam and Company. Sponsored by Nosler. Those of you tuning in on the web, just got to hear Jenna Waller talk about the great folks at Nosler helping out with her Wounded Warrior hunt. If you're listening on SiriusXM Patriot, go check out NRANews.com at some point. We've got all of the interviews, all of the videos. We're going to be talking to a lot of folks up there in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, at the Great American Outdoor Show next week. Just got an email, actually, from our friend Clinton Romachet, works a lot with Ad Corps Defense Medal of Honor recipient. Looks like he might be heading out to Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, so we might get a chance to have Clint on the program again next week. Right now, I want to welcome our friend Andrew Langer from the Institute for Liberty, who is making his way up to New Hampshire. How are you, sir?
I am steeling myself for the snow and cold of the Pine Tree State.
I was going to say, why are you driving into bad weather and not away? Why don't you just, you know, get a jump on South Carolina, Andrew?
You know, I go where I'm needed. You know, I'm like the paladin from the TV Western New York.
Just show up in a small town. Are you going to be in Cooter's Notch, or what's the first town that always reports in New Hampshire?
Oh, I don't.
Dix's Notch, something like that.
Hey, you know, it's I always want to say it's Gobbler's Knob, but that's of course in Punxsutawney Public.
Dixville Notch. I was
yes,
close. Yeah. Is that where we're going to find you?
You know something? You'll find me wherever the action is.
So probably not in Dixville Notch, population 12. It'd probably be...
You never know, man. I seem to find myself in these sorts of areas. I don't know. I'm going to be staying in Nashua. I have friends who are sort of scattered to the four winds. But yeah, I head up on Sunday. I have to help. I have to, you know, take care of stuff around the house. So I'm going to miss the debate tomorrow night. But it's interesting, man. This whole primary is just it's gone cuckoo Charlie, cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs.
It is. It's fascinating to watch. I mean, our Virginia primary is March the 1st, and I have a feeling that March 1st primary will either because there are so many primaries held around the country that day that things will either shake out. Or here's a bold political prediction, Andrew. Things will either shake out or they won't, right? Either March 1st will start to make things will start to make a little bit more sense. You'll see a path for a candidate or maybe two to victory. Or the other scenario is that, you know, a couple of candidates win a couple of states, a couple of candidates win over here, and it's just as confusing. And now we have a whole lot of the chessboard that has already been played. I honestly have no idea what's going to happen in the elections this year. As a student of history and somebody who loves this country's history, I'm fascinated by watching an election that I think
probably will be written about and read about 100 years from now.
Yeah, I think I think it's accurate, and I think you hit the nail on the head. Here's what I know, right? Iowa brought far more clarity than I thought it was going to bring. I think what we're seeing, especially with regards to the surge of Marco Rubio in the polls over the last couple of days, that's really interesting. But I think you hit the nail on the head, right? I mean, going out of this, Rubio, I think is going to come very close, if not outright win New Hampshire. I think the smart money is on him coming very close, but not winning. And then you really have a three-way race in South Carolina between Trump and Rubio and Cruz, and really, frankly, between Trump and Cruz, I think. But you're right. We could get all of this great clarity between now and South Carolina, or now and after South Carolina. And because there are so many big states involved in Super Tuesday, we could see all of that clarity get upended in an instant. And it's for those of us who are sort of students of politics or view politics as slightly more than a spectator sport, Lord knows, as much as I'd like to be the Ace Rothstein of political handicapping, I am the opposite of Ace Rothstein this year, to say the least.
And that's okay. Honestly, I think that's absolutely fine. Now, going into New Hampshire, I'll tell you one of the things that I'm interested in seeing. In Iowa, apparently, there were more Republicans voting in the caucus than there were Democrats. It was a record-setting turnout for Republicans, about 60,000 more than in 2012. But apparently there were about 180,000 Republicans, about 170,000 Democrats at the caucuses. That would be the first time that that's happened, Andrew. And so I'm very curious to see what the numbers will be like in terms of total turnout in New Hampshire for Republicans in the Democratic primary.
Well, the wild card, of course, in all this is what happens with the weather.
Mm-hmm.
It is New Hampshire, and yes, they are used to bad weather, but bad weather, depresses turnout. I think it'll be remarkable because New Hampshire's supposed to get snow Monday night into Tuesday and all day Tuesday. I think if you do have that massive turnout, it'll show you just how engaged the voters are. And the reality, of course, is you and I are sitting here talking about the Republican primary. It's really the Democratic primary that is totally up for grabs. And unlike Trump, and there's some question as to whether or not Donald Trump has an actual ground game, a grassroots campaign in these states. Bernie Sanders does have a grassroots campaign, and he is able to translate his enthusiasm amongst his supporters into primary votes.
No, I think that's absolutely right. And, we were just talking actually earlier in the show with Ed Morrissey about the new Quinnipiac poll, nationwide poll, showing Hillary Clinton support cratering over the last time they polled this question. They had her at 61-30 in a previous poll over Bernie Sanders, now 44-42 Clinton over Sanders nationwide. Sanders is widely expected to win New Hampshire handily. Then that big question again becomes South Carolina, where polls have shown Hillary Clinton beating Bernie Sanders roughly 2-1, right? 66% or so to Bernie Sanders, 33%. Will that tighten up? And, is Hillary Clinton the as we get closer to actually having a chance to vote, even Democrats having a chance to vote for Hillary Clinton, it strikes me, Andrew, that you're not seeing excitement build, you're seeing apprehension build among Democrats.
Yes. Yeah. It's interesting. It's very clear that despite her I guess this is it, Cam. It comes down to the exact same problems that plagued Hillary Clinton in 2008 are plaguing her now, which is to say that she is someone that they know. She's someone that, on paper has it all, but when you hold that paper up to scrutiny, it's like it's the same old, same old. And the Democrats don't want the same old, same old. Obviously, there's something weirdly ironic in turning to an aging white gentleman from Brooklyn as the new thing. But the same reason why a lot of Republican voters and a lot of independent voters are looking at Trump is the reason why they're looking at Bernie Sanders as well. And so she simply can't get traction for the same reasons why she couldn't get traction against Barack Obama.
I think that's absolutely right. And you know, it's interesting because you talk about Bernie Sanders not being the first person you think of, you know, as the choice for the youth vote. But again, I think that Bernie Sanders doesn't look, he brings his baggage. And I think if he becomes the candidate, that baggage will come out. But right now for primary voters, even voters in their 20s, they think they know who Hillary Clinton is, right? She's been a part of the political scene forever and ever. And if this is a quote unquote change election, then, you know, the old guy from Brooklyn may be the change agent because he's the one who's actually saying something different. Now, what he's saying is socialism, which is, you know, I think a topic for a whole other segment here, Andrew. In fact, the next time, music means we've got to run, but the next time we have you on, I want to talk about the number of people in the electorate who are identifying as socialists now turning up in the primaries. Anyway, be safe. Have fun. We've got to talk about Operation Choke Point as well. Andrew Langer joins from the Institute for Liberty. Stick around. Hour two of NRA News. Cam and Company is coming up right after this.
Here at the NRA annual meetings, and we're talking to Cliff Burgess, as we like to do a lot with the Firearms for Freedom program. Good to see you, Cliff.
How are you, Cameron?
I'm doing very well. The Firearms for Freedom program is really, you know, the NRA does a lot of neat things, but this is actually, it's one of my favorite things you guys do. What exactly do you do?
Well, what we do is we take donations of firearms, either ones or twos or whole collections, and some of the firearms go to the National Firearms Museum. If the donor wants that to happen and it fulfills a specific need. And the others are auctioned with 100% of the bid prices coming back to support the donor's intents as far as the NRA is concerned. It could go directly to the NRA. It could go to NRA ILA. It could go to any one of the 501c3 affiliates for tax deduction purposes. Some collections are turned into charitable gift annuities where the donor or the donor's wife, or the donor and his wife, will get an income stream for the rest of their lives. And the foundation, on average, will realize about 20% of the value of the collection. And they also get a tax break up front. And then many of the donations are to the 501c3s to get support the NRA, but also get tax deductions for the donors. And a lot of people are like me. They're old. And they get to a point where they look at their collections and they wonder where they're going to go.
Right.
And they want them to go to responsible owners. And so they feel that working through the National Rifle Association, that where the guns are promoted to its members, that they're people like themselves,
yeah,
who have a passion for the Second Amendment, who support freedom in general, that this is a way in which they can support the organization. There are a lot of times I get called by an heir or a widow, said my husband loved the NRA and he wanted you to have the guns. And that's where I come in and we begin to work with them. We will come in and inventory firearms if the widow doesn't know what to do. We will help her find what the values are. And when she's ready, we'll come in and do the pack up and we'll ship them either to the museum or to an auction facility and then provide accounting when everything is done. And many times, if the deceased had not provided for his widow, I will suggest the opportunity for them to use the guns to fund a charitable gift annuity. And I've had widows who have literally cried when they found that out. And then I've had others who've said, no, my husband loved the NRA. I want you to take the guns and do with what will be the best possible use for them. It's an amazing experience dealing with these people.
Your days just must be roller coasters, Cliff.
They are. They are up and down. Believe me, they are. They are. But it is a great program.
It really is. You do really great work, and the service is wonderful. Where should people go online or find out more to get more information?
Yeah. We have a website. It's at NRAFFF.com for NRA Firearms for Freedom. And you'll find contact information for me on there. And I'm former NRA employee who now works on contract part-time, but I'm really available almost 24/7. The phone rings at odd hours, the emails show up, and I'll get back to you, and we'll take it from there.
Welcome back. Hour two of NRA News, Cam and Company. Sponsored by Nosler. Starts right now. Sheriff David Clark joining us on the program. Talking about his work to get armed citizens their guns back. Also, Scott Olmstead from NRA's American Hunter magazine on the changing face of the California Fish and Game Commission. Politico reporting. Bloomberg could be a serious contender in 2016, his pollster says. Wall Street Journal op-ed running this week. Douglas Schoen, his pollster for Bloomberg, says that he could win as an independent. Schoen writes, as the results from the Iowa caucuses rolled in on Monday became more clear than ever, if former New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg ran for president as an independent, he would be a serious contender for the White House. Eliza Collins at Politico says pundits are missing the Americans in the middle who aren't angry or polarized but don't participate in Democratic or Republican primaries, Schoen argues. He points to the fact that just one-fifth of Iowans voted in Monday's caucuses. He says that's the new silent majority, the millions of people who don't participate in Democratic or Republican primaries. They are equally as fed up with the status quo, he says, but they have a different approach to problem solving and different policy prescriptions than those on the ideological extremes. Now, here's the thing. Turnout in Iowa may have been one-fifth of Iowans, but it was also record-high turnout over on the Republican side, right? 60,000 more caucus-goers than 2012. Not record turnout. I think the record for the Democrats, 240,000 in 2008. They had about 170,000. But there's nothing to indicate in the raw numbers that just because a majority of voters stayed home, therefore they're likely to turn out on Election Day. You can go back and you can look at every Iowa caucus that's ever been held, and you won't find a caucus in which a majority of Iowans voted. Nor, by the way, will you find anybody making the argument that, see, there's this great pool of people who didn't vote in the caucuses. That must mean they'll turn out for a third-party candidate. Because that is a leap of faith and not one of reason. Again, Douglas Schoen may have a vested interest in Michael Bloomberg running for president, being Bloomberg's pollster and all. He might be laying out his case for his boss to jump in and give Douglas Schoen a sack full of cash. But as far as an argument goes to try to document that that great middle who are polarized from either Democrats or Republicans, but who are eager to vote for a Bloomberg, it's a stretch too far. I think he's Schoen's absolutely right in acknowledging that the largest number, the largest group of voters in this country are unaffiliated voters. They don't identify as Republicans. They don't identify as Democrats. I don't think that automatically means that anybody slapping a no labels sticker on their forehead or proclaiming themselves to be some great independent automatically wins over those Americans. Again, I think a substantial portion of those Americans have said, forget it to voting. I think they've said, forget it to activism, unfortunately, to the detriment of this country, I think. But I don't think that they are eager waiting with anticipation for a Mike Bloomberg. Schoen says, who fits this bill? Who fits the bill of finding a different approach to problem solving and different policy prescriptions than those in the ideological extremes? Michael Bloomberg, Schoen says. Yeah. A centrist with a clear and arguably unique, Schoen says, record in business as an entrepreneur
And in politics, as a three-term mayor of New York, Mr. Bloomberg is a fiscally prudent conciliator who advances pro-growth policies and takes tough stands. Yeah. Yeah, he does take some tough stands on things like, you know, your individual right to keep and bear arms, how much soda you can have, how loud your iPod should be. You going to eat that? Oh, and again, then there was that tough stand that Michael Bloomberg took in Colorado. What was it, 2014? You know, there's a talk now after the Democratic debate last night of Hillary Clinton releasing the transcripts of the speeches that she gave to institutions like Goldman Sachs. Because transcriptions were made, but Hillary Clinton said, I don't want this public. Well, if you're running for president, you gave the speech, you got paid a ton of money for it. Why not let the people hear what you had to say? You gave a ton of speeches for a ton of money. Okay, well, let the people read what you said. Michael Bloomberg has one of these speeches. Colorado, the Aspen Institute. Michael Bloomberg spoke before a sold-out crowd there at the Aspen Institute. Decided that he didn't want this speech broadcast, even though it was recorded. And there was a reporter there covering the speech. Carl Herkenroder covered it for the Aspen Times. In the speech, he called Colorado's decision to legalize marijuana stupid. He admitted to smoking a joint in the 1960s. He said the drug is more accessible and more damaging today. He said, I couldn't feel more strongly about it. My girlfriend says it's no different than alcohol. It is different than alcohol. This is one of the stupider things that's happening across our country. And then he started talking about crime. And in a speech that, again, was recorded, but Bloomberg would not let out, the head of a major news company said, I don't want you to release the video of this speech that I made, even though it might be newsworthy. Bloomberg was asked by the director of the Center for Urban Innovation at the Aspen Institute, Jennifer Bradley, was moderating the event. What can the U.S. do to get people out of poverty? Michael Bloomberg responded that conventional wisdom points to education. But he said education isn't going to help uneducated adults. Bradley later asked how government can offer basic fairness to the children, quote, who have been failed. And Bloomberg, according to the Aspen Times, claimed that 95% of murders fall into a specific category. Male, minority, and between the ages of 15 and 25. And he said cities need to get guns out of this group's hands and keep them alive. He said, quote, these kids think they're going to get killed anyway because all their friends are getting killed. They just don't have any long-term focus or anything. It's a joke to have a gun. It's a joke to pull a trigger. At one point, the Aspen Times said, the former mayor brought up New York City's stop-and-frisk practices, which gained national attention in 2011. Bloomberg said that during his last year in office, a minister at a Baptist church in Harlem invited him to speak. He said, while I'm sitting there waiting for him to introduce me, he said to his congregation, you know, if every one of you stopped and frisked your kid before they went out tonight, the mayor wouldn't have to do it. And Bloomberg said, so I knew I was going to be okay with that audience. As I'm reading this piece of the Aspen Times, there's a section missing. I don't know when this got edited, but there was a line in this Aspen Times story about Bloomberg saying that we need to throw them up against the wall to get the guns out of the hands of the young minority males. Throw them all up against the wall. I don't see that in the Aspen Times story now. That's interesting. Have to see if we can use the Wayback Machine on the internet to try to find that quote, because it does appear that it's not on the Aspen Times website anymore. And of course, the video of that address to the Aspen Institute, Bloomberg blocked from release. So if Bloomberg does decide to get into the race, I know I, for one, would certainly like to see the former mayor of New York allow for the public release of his comments there, since they were videotaped. And if the media is interested in Hillary Clinton's speeches before groups like Goldman Sachs, why not pay attention to the speech made by the former mayor of New York, the head of Bloomberg News, that that he didn't really want out there publicly? I don't know, though. I'm the case that could be made for, or the case that Douglas Schoen is making, that yes, Bloomberg could win. I'm not convinced, but I'm not sure that Douglas Schoen was right in that to convince me. I think that Douglas Schoen was right in that to convince the guy who might hire him as his pollster, saying, listen, Mike, you can do this. Only 1/5 of the electorate voted in the Iowa primary. That means that 80% of the voters are just out there waiting for someone like you to come along and spend billions of dollars, hundreds of millions of dollars in polling, and billions of dollars on this campaign to get elected to be that that centrist, moderate, independent candidate that they've been craving. I just don't see it. Because, well, as I laid out, unfortunately in this country, we don't have a majority of voting age citizens turn out and vote. The answer on some side seems to be mandatory voting, make everybody have to vote, which strikes me as absolutely absurd. Because I think for a fairly substantial percentage of those Americans who choose not to vote, and I disagree, I think that we should vote. But I think that it is a conscious decision by a lot of these Americans to stay away from the polls. And I'm not sure that the former mayor of New York, the one of the richest men in the world trying to buy his way into the White House, is what they're waiting for. I'm not sure that's the guy or the candidate who's going to get them off the couch, who's going to say, now the system's fixed. Holy cow. No, I think he's the type of candidate that's going to make them roll their eyes and say, oh, great. Not what we were asking for. But that's just me. And I don't stand to make X number of millions of dollars as Bloomberg's pollster if he decides to get in. So I can certainly understand why Douglas Schoen would want to make the counter argument there. All right, we're going to take a quick time out in just a minute. David Clark, the sheriff of Milwaukee County, Wisconsin, is going to join us on the program talking about what he is doing to make sure that armed citizens get their guns back after they use them in self-defense. When we come back is what we'll talk about, an anti-gun bill popping up in the state of Maine. Stick around. We have much more NRA News Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, coming up next.
I'm speaking with Sergeant Major Lance Nutt. He's president and founder of Sheepdog Impact Assistance. Tell us what Sheepdog Impact Assistance is all about.
Well, when we refer to the term of sheepdog, it's referring to one of society's protectors. It's the men and women that serve in the military, law enforcement, fire and rescue ranks. It's that type of man or woman that's willing to put their life on the line for you and me, for everyday service and the things that we live and take for granted. It takes a unique individual to go out there and make sure that we're able to appreciate the freedoms that exist for us. And when we talk about society's protectors, it's truly its sheepdogs, those men and women willing to give it all.
So where did this concept come from?
Well, for us and myself as a Marine of 28 years, it was quickly understanding with multiple deployments under my back and so many of my own Marines and soldiers and sailors that I had served with, seeing the difficulties they had in returning home. Part of that was that continued service opportunity. When you step away from something that means so much to you, and having given so much of your life in service, we felt that we needed an organization that would give you that opportunity to continue giving back to your country. And we initially formed as a disaster response organization and have morphed into so much more that truly defines who and what we are as individuals, our members and our volunteers. But more importantly, we're making sure that those men and women that have suffered a traumatic injury, and that could be emotional or physical trauma, that we give them the opportunity to get up off their butts and continue to live their lives.
It's awesome. Sergeant Major Lance Nutt with Sheepdog Impact Assistance. How can we get more information about your wonderful organization?
Well, we encourage people to visit our website at www.sheepdogia.org, and that's that'll give them an opportunity to learn a lot more about what we're accomplishing and how we're helping these men and women continue on with their lives.
Thank you, sir. Thanks for what you're doing. Thanks for being on NRA News.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
Speaking with Marianne Johnson with the NRA Eddie Eagle Gun Safe Program. Marianne, welcome back to NRA News. Tell folks, what is the NRA Eddie Eagle Gun Safe Program?
So the Eddie Eagle Gun Safe Program is a firearm accident prevention education program for pre-K to fourth grade. It's all centered around Eddie's message, if you see a gun, stop, don't touch, run away, tell a grown-up.
Why does NRA do this?
We do it as a way to keep kids safe, get kids thinking about guns. We understand that 47% of American households have firearms in them, so kids need to know what to do when they see them.
It kind of follows with the NRA's bedrock message of gun safety and how important it is.
Absolutely, and that's why we do what we can and try to prevent as many accidents as possible.
And how does the NRA do it? How does the program work?
So the program, we work mostly with schools, law enforcement, libraries, healthcare providers, and daycares. We provide them with all of the materials that they need to run the program, including instructor guides, animated DVD, workbook stickers, and parents' guides for the kids to take home. So it's very easy to use, very accessible, and we're also able to offer all the material for free thanks to grant funding from the Friends of the NRA.
And there's that cool costume you might be able to get to bring to your school, right?
Absolutely, yes. We do have the mascot costume, which we're currently in the process of updating to go along with our new look that we have. And law enforcement agencies across the country all have costumes and add a whole new element to the presentation. We have a brand new website just for kids. It's eddieeagle.com. It has the video on it, has the Eddie Eagle challenge that kids can take, as well as coloring pages and some sing-along songs as well.
And Marianne, how do people get more information about the program?
The best way is either you can look us up online, eddieeagle.nra.org, or you can send us an email at eddie@nrahq.org.
Marianne Johnson, thanks for what you do, and thanks for being on NRA News.
Yep, thanks for having me.
Welcome back to NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler. Scott Olmstead of NRA's American Hunter going to join us a little bit later on in the hour. Sheriff David Clark of Milwaukee County, Wisconsin, will be with us here in just a couple of minutes talking about what he is doing to help ensure that armed citizens get their guns back after they use them in self-defense. In Maine, former Mayor Michael Bloomberg is trying to get a ballot measure before voters to require FFL be present and conduct a background check on every transfer and sale of a firearm, even those transfers between friends, those temporary transfers, well, someone's going to go hunting, something like that. And in the state of Maine, where you've got a lot of folks who live in very rural areas, I don't think this is likely to be successful, but anti-hunting activists, now anti-gun activists, have over the past couple of years, tried to get these ballot measures before the voters, and they've been successful at getting the measures on the ballot. There was the ballot measure to ban most forms of bear hunting in Maine that HSUS put on the ballot. The voters of Maine, however, rejected that measure when they had the opportunity to vote on it. So as the signature gathering process continues for this universal background check, quote-unquote, a ballot initiative will follow along. Also, though, some pro-gun legislation introduced in Maine. The Sun Journal reporting that State Senator Andre Cushing has introduced a bill that would ban gun bans in subsidized housing. The state senator says that the bill will start a conversation about the conflict between the rights of property owners and their tenants. The Sun Journal newspaper in Maine says the bill comes after Harvey Limbaugh, who uses a wheelchair, shot an alleged burglar in his Rockland home. He said he was defending himself. Police agreed, but his landlord told him that tenants are prohibited from having firearms in these subsidized apartments. So Harvey had to go. State Senator Andre Cushing says that landlords who accept public money shouldn't be allowed to violate their tenants' rights. Limbaugh is now suing the property management company as well as the owner of the property in which he lives. And, you know, we have seen gun bans struck down in public housing, thanks again in part to the work of the NRA over the years. You know, during our break, one of the spots that you'll see in our rotation is a Freedom Safest Place spot featuring a woman named Josephine Byrd. Josephine Byrd lives in Delaware. And she lived in public housing, lives in public housing in Wilmington, Delaware. And she wanted to have a gun for her protection because there were a lot of people who were illegally possessing guns, illegally using and dealing drugs where she lived. Wasn't the safest place. She wanted to be able to protect herself. The housing authority said no. You can't. We have a ban on gun ownership. So she sued. Was part of a lawsuit along with Charles Boone. And eventually they, with the help of the NRA, got the Wilmington Housing Authority to back down and get rid of their gun ban. So I'm with Harvey Limbaugh. If you have a right to keep and bear arms, that's your right to keep and bear arms. I don't think it goes away just because you were renting and not owning the property where you lay your head at night. Now, Sheriff David Clark of Milwaukee County, Wisconsin, is with us on the program right now. Sheriff, how you doing today?
Fantastic. Thanks for asking. How you doing?
I am excellent. I appreciate you coming on the program, and I'm absolutely fascinated about this topic here on armed citizens and you trying to get their guns back. This is, you know, this is a bigger problem, I think, than a lot of folks realize. An individual will use their firearm in self-defense, but that doesn't mean that there's not going to be a police investigation. The firearm may be seized during that investigation, but then once the investigation is over, it's not as if the gun automatically or easily is returned to the owner, right?
Right, and this is there's a signature case out of this, and you and I may have had this conversation a couple of years ago. There was a tavern holdup, and the tavern owner, Andy Kachansky, had a loaded firearm behind the bar to protect himself and his patrons and his employees. These three holdup men came in, and Andy Kachansky used deadly force, killed one of the holdup men. The other two fled like the little cowards that they were. And then, of course, as you indicated, there's a police investigation that's going to result. The police take that firearm for evidence testing. That's all legitimate stuff. That's a legitimate government interest to do that sort of thing. But Andy Kachansky was quickly cleared, like about 3 weeks later, maybe a month. The district attorney said that he acted in self-defense and the defense of his patrons, and no criminal charges would issue, and the Milwaukee Police Department wouldn't return his firearm. So Andy got me involved, and as the sheriff, and I started looking into it, and the state statute didn't really cover this situation because carrying concealed license is new. Castle Doctrine is new in Wisconsin. We didn't have that but for about 2.5-3 years ago. So Milwaukee Police Department Chief Ed Flynn has a policy of not returning firearms back to owners when they were used in some sort of incident. And I thought this is dead wrong. And we're going to see more of this because we have about 250,000 CCL, carrying concealed license holders in the state of Wisconsin. We are seeing these things where people are reasonably and justifiably law-abiding citizens defending themselves, with that firearm. And specifically in the city of Milwaukee, you know, nowhere in the rest of the state of Wisconsin was this really a problem, except for this anti-gun police chief Ed Flynn and the mayor Tom Barrett, who was one of the leaders of the Mayors Against Guns. So I thought we needed a statute to cover these individuals, and here's why. This gun that Andy owned had a value of about $450. If he would have had to hire an attorney to get this gun back, he may well have run up legal bills twice the value of that gun. Why should Andy have to pay some attorney $1,100 to get a gun back that's worth $450? So I thought the state needed to protect these individuals in these circumstances. They did. And we now have a bill that requires the police agency, the investigative agency, to return the firearm no more than 10 days after the decision's made that no criminal charges are warranted.
That is fantastic. And again, I mean, this is one of those truly common sense pieces of legislation. I know that phrase gets overused a lot, and it certainly gets used a lot by the anti-gun side, but this is really common sense. As you say, if the police investigation is over, there are no charges forthcoming, there's no reason for the police department to keep a hold of that gun unless, you know, you've got an anti-gun chief of police who doesn't think that people should have a firearm for self-defense, in which case he's going to make it as hard as possible for people to get that gun back.
Right. Here's what's important to me as well. You know, I'm known as, and I refer to myself as the people's sheriff. I'm on the side of the people. I'm on the side of the law-abiding public here. And this guy needed some help, Andy Kuchanski, and he reached out to me. And I needed to put my money where my mouth was if I'm going to say I'm the people's sheriff. I doubt that Andy would have got this legislation through on his own. He could have petitioned his state assembly person or state senator, and I doubt it. It would have even gotten off the ground. So he needed a little muscle, and he needed the name behind it. I work for people, and this is one of my roles that an elected representative is supposed to play. It's supposed to be on the side of people. So when I said at the time, when this whole thing started, I believe I talked about this on your program, I said I'm going to try to get a bill introduced to have these firearms returned in a reasonable amount of time. And like I said, that was about 18 months ago, and when I say something, I'll tell you what, I mean it.
I think I remember having that conversation with you because I know we talked with you after this case happened and Andy Kuchanski defended himself. And you know, working through the legislative process here, Sheriff, this is not something that a sheriff typically does as part of their job duties. What has this process been like to be involved and see how the sausage gets made, so to speak?
Well, it's been very gratifying for me that I'm able to help the law-abiding people in Milwaukee County whittle through this morass of all these laws and regulation. There's this overbearing power grab by governmental entities like Chief Ed Flynn and the Milwaukee Police Department. This is no reflection of the officers, by the way. This is the administration. And so, you know, I have this position. It does have some authority, but that authority is granted by the consent of the governed. And I come back, you know, I'm a constitutionalist, and I'm grounded in this concept of the rule of law, that the Constitution prevails, that we the people are in charge. And so it's been very gratifying for me with this, the authority that I've been granted by the electorate here in Milwaukee County that I can use it to help them. Here's another thing to think about, theoretically, with what happened to Andy Kuchanski. It was the only gun he had. Mm-hmm. So once the Milwaukee Police Department took it away from him, he had no other way of defending himself. This is not a wealthy guy. As a matter of fact, the prosecutor in the case who said, yeah, I'm not going to issue any charges, he made this statement to my adjutant when we were trying to work through this to get this released. He says, hey, the sheriff's a big NRA guy. I'm sure he can find somebody to buy Andy Kuchanski a new gun. That was what he said.
Wow.
Okay, so now Andy has no way to defend himself. He couldn't afford another gun. And so what about his constitutional right to keep and bear arms? So the Milwaukee Police Department was infringing on his constitutional right. This was not just about the return of the firearm, but although that is a private property issue because that property belonged to Andy, and he used it reasonably and lawfully And so for somebody to hold on to it for as long as they did, it took him, like I said, about 18 months to get his gun back. Here's another case. A $5 million Stradivarius violin was stolen from a musician in Milwaukee in a strong-arm robbery. When the police recovered that violin, within a week they returned it to the owner, and they should have, within a week, okay, because that violin belonged to that musician. And with the rules of evidence, you can take a picture of it. The courts have already decided a picture facsimile is okay to produce in court. You don't need the actual instrument. And you don't want to damage that thing if you're the Milwaukee Police Department. They returned that to that musician in a week, but yet it took Andy Kachansky a year and a half to get his property back only because Ed Flynn doesn't like guns.
And Sheriff, you know, it should be noted, Chief Flynn may not like firearms, and he may have this anti-gun attitude that he tries to put into action at any given opportunity. It doesn't seem to be doing a whole heck of a lot for violent crime in Milwaukee.
No, and just last week, again, he was out there blaming the increased violence. We had, I think, the second highest total of homicides in the city's history last year, about 145. I think the record was 167. That happened back when I was with the homicide unit in the Milwaukee Police Department as a homicide detective. But, again, he reached out and said it's the proliferation of guns. He blamed the carrying concealed license legislation for all the violence in the city. When I think to date, like I said, this year there's about 250,000 CCL holders. I think one has been charged and adjudicated for using that weapon unlawfully. Okay, one. And so he's going to sit up there and blame this black subculture behavior that goes on in the American underclass, in the ghetto. He wants to blame that on me. He wants to blame it on Andy Kachansky. He wants to blame it on law-abiding citizens. And I think that's sick. So, you know, again, he's with that ilk that has this anti-gun sentiment. They want to blame it for everything. Same thing's going down. On down in Chicago. In the month of January this year, 51 people murdered, 242 others shot in non-fatal shootings in the first month of the year. That is a record that beat out 2000 in the year 2000 when Chicago had just a few less than that. So again, you know, got Rahm Emanuel down in Chicago. You had the former superintendent, Gary McCarthy, and now this new guy. They want to blame the guns. They want to blame everything. They want to blame the law-abiding citizen. They want to blame everybody, but where the real fault of this lie, this is subculture behavior. When you use firearms to intimidate, when you use firearms to take property, you stick a gun against somebody's head, you steal their car, you steal their wallet, when you use firearms in that sort of fashion, which only a very small segment of the population does, and that's the criminal element. Instead of focusing on them, which is what I do, this subculture behavior, they want to focus on the hundreds of thousands of people in the city of Milwaukee and the millions in the state of Wisconsin who own firearms that would never do something like that with that instrument.
Absolutely. Barking up the wrong tree. And as you say, you know, generally speaking, the people in the most violent prone neighborhoods in Milwaukee, they know who the bad actors are. They know who's committed this violence. I imagine the cops in the patrol cars have a pretty good idea of who the most violent offenders in these neighborhoods are. But yet we're going to focus all of the anti-gun attention, the legislative attention, the cultural attention on legal gun ownership, as opposed to reaching out and actually making sure that those violent offenders are off of the streets.
You know, it's the revolving door nature of the criminal justice system in Milwaukee County that I've been harping on for the last decade, that is responsible for a lot of this repeat behavior. The Milwaukee police officers, my sheriff's deputies, we go out, we arrest these individuals over and over and over again for serious stuff, and then the court just turns around and kicks them right back out into the streets to reoffend. What about the good law-abiding people, black people, I'll add, in the American ghetto that are living in fear? Their kids can't play out in front of their homes. We had a 10-year-old girl shot in the head in a crossfire as she played on a swing set on a city playground in the middle of summer. It's, and both of those guys had extensive criminal histories, serious criminal histories, including gun charges. But we're up against that as well. That's where I'm putting my focus on. That's what I keep talking about with these anti-gun nuts like Bloomberg, like Mayor Tom Barrett and Chief Ed Flynn. They really have it out for the NRA. Ed Flynn's always blaming the NRA, other gun owner groups. And this is what I'm fighting here in the Milwaukee area. But I'll tell you what, you guys have been great in allowing me your platform to call up the posse, order up the posse, so that we can push back against this this crazy movement.
Listen, Cher, we're always happy to provide you with a microphone. We love having you on the program, and hope we get a chance to do this again very soon.
My pleasure.
All right, thank you, sir. Sheriff David Clark, the sheriff of Milwaukee County, Wisconsin, joining us here on NRA News, Cam and Company. How about that? Getting involved with the a process there to have a firearm returned to a law-abiding individual there. And as he said, this doesn't seem to be a problem in Appleton or in Green Bay or in Eau de Claire, right? Nope, seems to be a problem in Milwaukee where somebody can use a firearm for self-defense. Again, the investigation is completed. The individual not facing any charges, but the property is not returned to him or her. And the attitude that the sheriff described by the, I think it was a city attorney. Well, hey, you know, you know a lot of people in the NRA. I'm sure somebody would buy him a gun. Is that the standard now? When we're talking about justice? If somebody has their car seized, and all of a sudden not facing any charges, we keep their car and, hey, you know, you're big in the AAA. You could probably get somebody to, right? Find him a good deal for a car somewhere. You know somebody who works at Auto Trader, right? You know somebody who works at the car dealership. I'm sure you got somebody with deep pockets who could buy some property to replace the property that we're keeping from that individual who's not facing any charges. Now, that is, at the end of the day, again, not a common sense gun safety rule. That is not a gun violence prevention strategy. That's not a measure that's going to increase or add to public safety. It is a pure and simple anti-gun move to tell a law-abiding gun owner, you can't have your firearm back. We're going to keep it because we can. All right, stick around. Scott Olmstead from NRA's American Hunter Magazine going to join us. We're going to talk about what's going on in California, where the Fish and Game Commission isn't quite as pro-hunting as it used to be. Story in the Sacramento Bee about this a couple days ago. We'll talk with Scott Olmstead about it right after a quick timeout here on NRA News, Cam and Company.
I'm speaking with Mark Velarde with Shoot for a Cure. Mark, thanks for being on NRA News.
Thanks, John. I appreciate you having me here.
Tell us, what is Shoot for a Cure all about?
Shoot for a Cure, we're a national nonprofit. This is our 14th year. We go all over the country. We raise money for folks with leukemia, people with MS, and various other charitable causes. And since we've started, we've introduced over 1,600 people, new people, to the shooting sports, to sporting clay shooting, and we've raised $2.9 million net.
Wow.
For leukemia research, MS research.
So how did this all start?
On a dare. We were pheasant hunting, and somebody was commiserating about all the stupid golf tournaments we have to do, and somebody says, well, we should do a pheasant hunt for charity. I said, nah, if you do a pheasant hunt, you're not going to get anybody. I said, but if you did a sporting clay shoot, you'd get people to come. And it was like everybody just stopped. And they looked at each other and they went, okay, do it.
Do we have an aha moment?
Yeah.
Aha. Uh-huh.
Yeah, so I'm like, okay. And so we did the first year, and we had, I think, 70 shooters. We raised 12 grand. And we did that for a couple of years, and then people started calling. Hey, can you bring that event up to Spokane? Can you bring that event to Southern Cal? Because we're out in Northern California. So, okay, we can do it. So then we had to figure out how to do the road show. Okay, what do we need? We need guns. We need sponsors. We need a trailer. We need staff. So I talked to people in the industry that I knew. We all became certified instructors. We got a trailer. I came to my first SHOT Show, met Scott and met Carlo. And
how many years ago was that?
That was 14 years.
Oh, man.
So, and it was amazing the response we've gotten. And now we started with one event in Northern Cal. This year coming, we're going to have 17 events coast to coast. My program goal is $650,000. By the way, I forgot to tell you, last year was our record. When I first started this, I said to my buddy, I said, wouldn't it be nice if we could shoot all over the country and raise $500,000 for kids with cancer? And he says, yeah, that'd be nice. Well, guess what? We did it last year. $516,000 net we're sending to those charities. And we had 1,530 shooters at our events.
Wow.
It's awesome. And every year at some point in this show, I will cry. I'm just a big softie.
Well, I'll tell you what, Mark, you've got, and I love it, you have passion, you have enthusiasm. What? And you've been doing this for 14 years.
Yeah.
What keeps that fire alive in you to do this?
A couple of things. I met some patient heroes a couple of years ago. And when you see the kids and they're standing there and you know the little girl's got a wig on, she's been through hell. I can say hell, can't I?
Yeah.
Been through hell and she still manages a smile on her face. And I've got two daughters. And you just go home and hug your kids, and you thank God. And then it's like, I can help. We can do something to help. 2 years ago, leukemia came out with a new form of research. They took the HIV, the AIDS virus, and they took the stinger out of it, you know, the stuff that makes us sick.
Right.
And they retrained those T cells to, instead of attacking healthy cells, they're attacking cancer cells. And there's a video on our website called Fire with Fire. Leukemia Senate said, put this on your website. I cry every time I watch it. This girl was 2 weeks from dead. She was blue. They've tried everything. Just as a last-ditch effort, they did this, and they almost lost her. And 48 hours later, the color came back to her body. And it was like 6 years ago. 8 years, like now, she's living a normal, healthy life. And now, because of what they did with that virus, it's transforming into, it's going to change bone cancer, it's going to change breast cancer, it's the beginning of the end.
Yeah, and all that on top of that, you're introducing people, instead of going to a golf tournament,
right,
into the shooting sports and kindling or rekindling our love for that as well.
Absolutely. You know how many people we see, they're like, they come out and they go, you know, I haven't shot this gun since I was 10 years older. This is my grandpa's 870.
Yeah.
And you get it, and it's like, so I have an armorer. Remington gives me parts. We send it to the armorer. They clean it up. They put new seals in it, new piston. The guy goes out, and he's happy. He's having that experience he last had when he was 10 years old, and we're giving it to him. And we're raising money for kids, you know.
Mark, how can people get more information about Shoot for a Cure?
Go to the website, shootforacure.us.
Welcome back to NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler. Coming up top of the hour, we have our Hero of the Day, sponsored by AdCourt Fence. Deal of the Day, Good Guy of the Day, plus a Charles Cook of National Review on the another record month for gun sales in the country. And Tony Cash joining us as well next hour. Right now, I want to welcome to the program Scott Olmstead from NRA's American Hunter Magazine. Scott, how are you, sir?
Hi, I'm good, Cam. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's good talking with you today. I saw the story in the Sacramento Bee yesterday, and I figured, you know, you are the master of all things hunting, and I know that this is a concern for hunters and outdoorsmen because California, you know, despite the really awful gun laws on the books, there's a lot of great hunting, at least there can be, in the state of California. But as the Sacramento Bee is reporting, a lot of hunters are afraid that the Fish and Game Commission there in the state is turning anti-hunting.
You know, this has been a trend for a while at the California Fish and Game Commission and on the Department of Fish and Wildlife. Actually, preceding Kellogg's resignation were a few others. The executive director of the Fish and Game Commission resigned just 2 weeks prior to Kellogg. Department of Fish and Wildlife Deputy Director retired just a week prior. the Fish and Game Commissioner, Jack Bayless, also turned in his resignation to the commission. And these only follow departures in the past couple of years. So they do have a problem out there. You know, one element of news is timeliness and impact. It would have been nice if the state capitol paper of record, Sacramento Bee, got on this story a little sooner. They're only about, you know, a month late on the news and a couple of years late on the trends.
And they're right there in Sacramento. But as the Sacramento Bee points out, they say there are about 1.7 million licensed California anglers, about 250,000 hunters among the nearly 39 million people living in California. I'm guessing, Scott, that, you know, maybe even the reporters for the Sacramento Bee, the Ryan Sabalo, David Siders, unless they're hunters or anglers themselves, this is one of those stories that may not have caught their attention, may not have caught their eye. Unfortunately, yeah. This is why, you know, we need magazines like American Hunter, why we need programs like NRA News that are actually covering issues like this, because, you know, I'm afraid that in California, the hunters and anglers and outdoorsmen are seen as an afterthought.
Yep, yeah, and as Kellogg points out, he's afraid that he'll see fishing and hunting dwindle to the point of absolute obscurity. Maybe not, he says, in his lifetime, but he's afraid his grandkids will see it in their lifetime. I certainly hope he's wrong, but I understand where that sentiment comes from, particularly in a state like California. I would bet the reporter for the Sacramento Bee, this didn't catch your eye because they're likely not hunters or fishermen, and so they did not realize the impact or the proximity that this trend has on millions of Californians, not just hunters and fishermen. You know, remember President Obama several years ago was famously quoted as saying, you didn't build that to small business owners. Well, I would tell the non-hunters and fishermen of the world, we built this. We built things like the Fish and Game Commissions and the Departments of Fish and Wildlife around the country. We built the game populations and the wildlife populations and the landscapes and habitat to support all fish and wildlife around the country. We did build this as hunters, as conservationists, and we handed this to the American public, and now it's being wrested away from us, and that's a dangerous trend.
Absolutely. The Sacramento Bee quotes an attorney with the Anti-Hunting Center for Biological Diversity, the group that tried to get the EPA to ban all lead ammunition, and they were pushing the lead ban for hunting in California. This guy, Brendan Cummings, says, all too often in the past, we've seen commissioners basing their decisions on simply pleasing the hunting constituency, regardless of what the law or the science should dictate. They have been, as the Bee points out, among those pushing for bans on hunting of predators, or at least a greater restriction on the hunting of predators in California, which I have to say, Scott, always strikes me as a bit of a speciesist argument. Say that the predators are okay, even if there are humans who are harmed by the increased number of predators going after their livestock, family pets, who knows, maybe even attacks on humans in California.
Yeah, I find it's actually quite rich. Somebody like I have my eye on that quote, too. And I think it's quite rich when he says, regardless of what the law or the science should dictate. Really? It's hypocritical because groups like the Center for Biological Diversity will push their agenda flatly in the face of existing science.
What do you mean by that? Can you give me an example?
For somebody like that to say that they're behind science when they're pushing really a personal agenda based on, as you say, species specific. They're too often succeeding in separating hunters because some people would say, well, I don't hunt cougars, or yeah, I don't agree with hunting bears with dogs, so I can go along with that. It's the same argument that is tried used to separate gun owners, and it just simply should not stand.
Absolutely. I mean, especially when you consider the money that hunters and anglers and outdoorsmen have put into conservation efforts over the decades. And frankly, Scott, and I'm sure that you run into this anti-hunting attitude all the time where people say, oh, if you're a hunter, you must hate animals, you must want to see all the animals blown away. There is nobody, I think, that is more interested in conservation and ensuring that our children and our grandchildren still have the same opportunities to explore nature and interact with wildlife, not just through hunting, but yes, including hunting. But in order for that to happen, you need a stable and growing game population. And frankly, managed hunting provides that.
Yeah, when people say things like that to me, or hunters should realize when they're told things like that, it's the first reaction is to use the old phrase, you know, well, if I have to explain it to you, you wouldn't understand. But we have to resist that urge, because we are forced to repeatedly and explain ourselves and explain it to them, because they just don't get it. A statement like that belies their ignorance of the issue. We do care about all things in nature. That's communing with nature is the primary factor that gets us out there in the field. It's not about the kill at the end of a successful hunt. A hunt can still be successful just by having that day out there alone in your wanderings. And if people, they don't understand that, they think, well, how can we possibly love animals and then want to kill them? Well, you know, the simple trite answer is it tastes good. But I mean, it's far greater than that. Like you said, that's a simple and trite answer. There's so many things that go to it. It's a primary urge. It's a primal urge in humankind, I think, that goes back as old as the species. And the people who don't understand that, they just don't get it. We have to continue to try to get them to understand it.
And you know, Scott, I think we are making inroads in some ways. We've talked, we were at SHOT Show recently talking with Scott Laseth, the sporting chef. About you know, the foodie culture and the number of chefs and people within the food industry who are becoming hunters, or at this point now have been hunters for several years, but you know, there is, you know, that trite answer that you gave of it tastes good. There's something really to that, and there's also something to the idea of knowing where your food comes from. And you know, it's one thing. The thing that drives me the craziest is when I hear people who I know eat meat, who I know buy their food all from the grocery store, complain about the cruelty of hunters when they have no idea what goes into the dinner that they just consumed, where I think every hunter actually does understand.
That's a fact, yeah.
And so, you know, I think that's one of the things that we actually have to really combat and try to educate folks on is, you know, it's really is a matter of, the hunters that I know are much more self-aware of the real cost of that meal on your plate, not just the dollars and cents cost, but the fact that something had to die in order for you to eat. And that's the case, and that's part of human nature. But I think it's a part of human nature that a lot of us try to deny.
Yeah, and you know, and the other side, as it were, is continually trying to usurp that message in what I think is practically insidious ways. The Sacramento Bee says the board's only remaining hunter now is Eric Sklar. He's a winery owner, and Sklar in the Sac D's article goes on to explain that philosophically as a hunter, he believes you should eat what you kill. He says, I'm a hunter. I'm not a big supporter of killing for sport or for trophies. He's trying to usurp our message here. I would tell people like that. First of all, according, I think Jim Kellogg would disagree that Eric Sklar is even a hunter. So the Sacramento Bee might have that wrong. Secondly, it's all sport hunting and trophy hunting these days. Let's be frank about it. We don't have to hunt in order to survive, unless we're Inuits or San Bushmen in Namibia who are subsistence hunting. We would be better off getting a second job as a Walmart greeter if we need more money to feed our families. But that's not what drives us. So let's be honest about, yes, we benefit by getting to eat pure organic protein that we bring home from the field, but we don't have to do that to survive. Mm-hmm. So in that vein, it is sport hunting. We can call it what it is. That doesn't make it wrong, not by a long shot. But these people would try to separate our message, and even hunters among us, into believing, yes, you absolutely have to eat what you kill. Well, what about, is it okay if I don't eat it, but somebody else does, if I donate it to Hunters for the Hungry? Is that acceptable to these people? Give me a break.
All I know is, Scott, I'm not eating coyote, even though
yeah.
they might be coming after my chickens. I'm going to try to put that coyote down, but I'm not eating it afterwards, and I'm going to feel okay with my decision.
Yeah, and all the vegans out there who disregard the fact that thousands of animals, even down to crickets and bugs, have died in order to provide them with their salad. That's the fact. That's the natural fact and the economic fact behind their all-vegan lifestyle. Even they cause animals to die in order to live their so-called meat-free existence.
Absolutely. I mean, that's just part of the circle of life. That, again, in order for you to eat, whether you're a vegetarian or a meat eater, something living isn't living any longer in order to sustain your life. And when you are aware of that, again, I think that you have a different relationship with the environment, with the flora and the fauna in the great outdoors. Listen, Scott, unfortunately, we are almost out of time, but I really appreciate you coming on the program. It's a pleasure talking with you again.
Well, thanks for inviting me anytime, Cam.
You bet. We'll talk again very soon. Scott Olmstead joined us from American Hunter Magazine here on NRA News, Cam and Company. Now, coming up, top of hour three, Hero of the Day, sponsored by AdCorp Defense, our Deal of the Day, Good Guy of the Day as well. Plus, we'll check in with Charles Cook of National Review, who says gun sales continue at an extraordinary pace. Because, you know, Charles is British after all. January, another big month for background checks. National Instant Check System showing about 2.5 million background checks performed. Now, that was down from December, but it was also up considerably over January of 2015. Combine that number, again, with stories like what we talked about with Ed Morrissey, the concealed carry rates in Minnesota skyrocketing, well over 200,000 concealed carry holders now. Concealed carry applications skyrocketing in North Dakota and in other parts of the country. This is not a blip. This is not a regional trend. This is more Americans coming to embrace their rights. Stick around. We'll be right back.
I'm speaking with Michael Faw of Crimson Trace. Michael, how are you, sir?
Good, John. How are you today?
I am doing great. Thanks for being back here on NRA News. All right, so ran into you here. You've got a really cool new product to show us. Tell folks, what is Crimson Trace? What do you guys do?
Crimson Trace is a laser sighting manufacturer out in the Portland, Oregon area. We make more than 200 laser sighting systems for firearms. We also make military sighting hardware.
How does Crimson – give us a quick story of how Crimson Trace came about as a company.
Came up with an idea from our founder, Lou Danielson, and then that was more than 20 years ago. We've been in business that long, and the product lines have evolved since then. So it was a concept he had, and he just grew it into what today is known as Crimson Trace, the
right.
Great American story.
And I'll tell you what, what did you mention before we went there? What, over 200 product lines?
Over 200 products. We have red and green laser sighting systems now.
It's awesome. And I'll tell you what, Michael, when you talk to people in the industry, in shooting sports competitive, no matter what, it's one of those names, Crimson Trace is, you know, everyone knows about it. You talk about having a strong brand.
One of the reasons we have so many products, we listen to customers. We know that a lot of NRA members are current customers, and we listen to what customers ask for or suggestions, and that's where the product base grows from.
And you also mentioned something about NRA members.
Yes. All of our employees are also NRA members. We pay the membership for the ones who don't join on their own, but we're all 100% NRA.
And it's so awesome, Michael, when a manufacturer understands that we're all in this fight together.
And they enjoy also getting the magazines and their hats.
I love it. Speaking with Michael Faw, and he's the public and media relations manager for Crimson Trace. All right, so show us what you got, my friend. What is this?
Okay, this year we're known also for innovation. We've come up with a wireless system. The module is activated by the grip. So you can take your standard AR rifle grip off, and as long as your gun also has a rail somewhere on it, you can attach the module. So this grip is paired with that sight. So it's a laser and a light. So you can activate it this, and it's... There's more than 256 different signatures and codes that those two pieces of equipment communicate with, so there's no hacking it or no problems or anything else. So it's a wireless system designed by Crimson Trace.
Laser and a light in a wireless system, pretty cool stuff. So tell folks, what's the advantage of having a system like this?
It leaves you've got one hand that's control of your firearm. You've got the other hand that's free. You don't have to keep reaching up. You don't have to worry about wires. You don't have to worry about cables or anything else that's getting snagged on anything if you're moving through either the brush or a building or anything. So we know that this has hunting applications for people who are pursuing pigs and coyotes. And then it also has home defense applications. And we are growing the number of modules and the options that will be available, but it will all be controlled by the grip, the pistol grip.
It has applications here with the NRA News Crew. As soon as you broke it out, we're showing to everyone. Just about everybody here wants to get one.
Folks are lined up at the booth also looking at it. And yesterday at the range, we had an event, and people were lined up and just, you know, let me see this. We've heard all about it.
Let me see it. Let me have one.
Let me have one is the big request.
Michael Fall with Crimson Trace. How can folks get more information about Crimson Trace?
Obviously, crimsontrace.com. is the fastest way to get information. And we also have more than 2,500 dealers across the U.S. So most gun ranges and gun shops sell our products. They can go in there and look at a catalog, or they can call 800-442-2406 and request a catalog. We'll send a free one. The website's also a store. They can buy stuff there. We know that all dealers don't necessarily stock all 200 products.
Michael, thank you so much for what you do, and thanks for being on NRA News.
Hey, John, thanks for having me.
Welcome back. Hour three of NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, starts right now. With the hero of the day, deal of the day, good guy of the day, Charles Cook of National Review joins on the program. Tony Katz, host of Tony Katz in the Morning News, will be with us as well, coming to you from Farmville, Virginia this afternoon. But on Monday's program, we will be in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania at the Great American Outdoor Show, which opens its doors to the public tomorrow, February the 6th, runs through February 14th, Sunday, February 14th, and it is going to be an absolutely fantastic event. If you have never been to Harrisburg, if you've never been to the Great American Outdoor Show, the Pennsylvania Farm Show Complex, come on down at some point over the next 9 days. There's going to be lots of activities. Phil Robertson going to be speaking, a NRA country concert, I believe, Saturday night, February 13th. Tomorrow is the NRA Foundation banquet at 6:30 in the evening. And we will be, again, broadcasting live Monday and Tuesday of next week. I will be up there all weekend long as well. So if you're planning on heading out to Harrisburg, make sure you stop by the NRA news booth and say hello. All right, let's get to the deal of the or the hero of the day. Sponsored by AdCorps Defense, comes to us from ABC 30 out in Fresno, California, KFSN. Brian Johnson reporting that a Sanger, California man literally takes matters into his own hands by using his gun to detain a burglar until deputies arrive. Video from the Fresno County Sheriff's Office helicopter shows the Sanger homeowner waving for Fresno County deputies with one hand. With the other, he points his gun at the man that just tried to steal things from inside of his home. The homeowner, who didn't want to identify himself on camera, says he was finishing some yard work Thursday night. He went to go back inside, but his front security door was locked, which he knew he did not do. So he looked through the window, and he saw somebody inside his house, about 10 feet away from him. The homeowner had his gun in his pocket, so he pulled it out. The man said, "I pointed it right at him. He saw it. I said, 'Freeze, don't move.' But it was a shock for about 3 or 4 seconds. I didn't know what he was going to do, whether shoot me or stab me or whatever." Now, 54-year-old Enrique Garza was taken into custody by sheriff's deputies along with Sanger police officers. He did not have any weapons on him. He was arrested for burglary, misdemeanor drug possession, and violating probation. Mm-hmm. Out on probation. Fresno County Sheriff's Office says the homeowner was lucky to have a gun on him when he needed to use it. He has had a concealed carry permit with the county for 50 years. And this is the first time that he's ever had to draw his firearm. The sheriff's deputy spokesman, Tony Boddy, or sheriff's office spokesman, Tony Boddy, did not say, "See, look, this guy's had his concealed carry license for 50 years. This is the first time he's had to use it. Why does anybody need a concealed carry license? That's crazy, right?" That's not what he said. What he said was, quote, "If not for having a CCW, he probably wouldn't have had his gun on him. It probably would have been locked in a safe, and he wouldn't have had access to it in order to hold this suspect accountable." Huh. Interesting. Now, the homeowner says he doesn't always carry his gun, says he's fairly selective about where he carries it. ABC 30 said that won't change. Neither will his steadfast attitude of always being aware of his surroundings. He said you have to learn to be careful in this world because there's a lot of crazy people out there. And by the way, ABC Fresno pointed out that before the attacks in San Bernardino, Fresno County Sheriff's Office was approving concealed carry applications in about a month. They say now with the amount of requests, the waiting period is about 10 months in Fresno, California. Now, these aren't the same number of people going to the gun store buying, you know, 20, 30, 50 firearms, right? Because the anti-gun advocates say we have fewer Americans owning firearms. We have fewer Americans who are exercising the right to keep and bear arms. But it sure sounds like in Fresno County, they have a lot of individuals who would like to, for the very first time, become a concealed carry holder. And I'm guessing that a substantial number of those individuals who, for the very first time, would like to have their concealed carry license, they are recent gun owners. Now, ABC 30 doesn't say what the prospects are of the Fresno County Sheriff's Office being able to hire additional help that could bring that waiting period down from a from 10 months back down to a month. But again, those two figures should give you an idea of just how popular concealed carry is becoming. And not just in places like West Virginia or Wyoming. Oh, no, no. California, too. And that homeowner in Sanger, California, today's hero of the day. Our deal of the day is from New York City. The New York Daily News, I thought about using another news source because, you know, the New York Daily News is the one that really hates the NRA, hates Wayne LaPierre, thinks that you're a terrorist because you're an NRA member. But I think it's interesting that the New York Daily News, Rocco Periscanadola, Thomas Tracy, Kerry Burke, and Dennis Slattery wrote this story, and I'm guessing the editors of the New York Daily News read this story, considered the facts in this story, and still haven't changed their mind about who is to blame for violent crime. They're still going to hold you accountable and not the violent criminals. They're still going to write more editorials about the gun laws in this country and not the criminal justice system. There were two New York police officers who were wounded last night in a shootout in a housing complex, New York City Housing Authority housing complex in the Bronx. The suspect in the case ended up killing himself. Started when these housing officers conducting a routine vertical patrol at the Melrose houses. That means they're going up and down the staircases. They saw two men drinking beer in a stairwell. They asked for ID. Now, here's the deal. This is not likely to lead to major charges. You drinking a beer in a stairwell. Cops are looking for something a little bit more severe, right? Worst that happens is probably they're going to take away your beer. But one of these guys illegally had possession of a firearm. He was in possession of a handgun. He also was in possession of a black duffel bag with a sawed-off shotgun in it. He said he had to go upstairs to get his ID. He started to walk away and then turned and fired at the officers. Diara Cruz hit in the torso. Patrick Espiot shot in his cheek. Thankfully, both officers are expected to survive. The Daily News says the attacker, whose sources and the man's friends identified as 23-year-old Malik Chavez, then ran into a seventh-floor apartment where he told friends, "I just shot a policewoman. I ain't going back to jail." The 23-year-old, according to the New York Daily News, has 17 prior arrests at age 23. He was released from prison in December of 2014 after doing time for attempted robbery, records show. New York Daily News doesn't say how long he was in prison for that robbery. Meanwhile, Mayor de Blasio says this is another example of what our officers confront every single day, keeping us safe, not only in the streets of New York City, but in the stairwells and the hallways of our public housing developments. Police say the second suspect, who ran when he heard the gunshots in the stairwell, later surrendered, was being questioned early on Friday. Three other people in the apartment also being questioned. Chief of Detectives Robert Boyce said of the officers being in the building, it was a routine patrol. Again, they were walking their beat. The chief detective said that the stairwell was well lit. Unlike the New York Daily News says, the darkened steps at a Brooklyn housing complex that saw a similar patrol end with a rookie cop shooting an unarmed man dead in 2014. What that has to do with the shooting last night, I have no idea. Fairly certain the New York Daily News doesn't either. But here you have a suspect in this case, 23 years old, 17 arrests to his name, at least one conviction. We don't know how many other convictions. Daily News says that this housing association, big building, this complex located in the 40th precinct, had a 24.5% crime increase in the city. The 40th precinct where this housing complex is located. That was the largest increase in New York City in 2015. Crime up 25%. Police Commissioner Bill Bratton took to Twitter to say, proud of my officers, hopeful for their speedy recovery, grateful for the many expressions of concern and support on their behalf. And I hope that you will keep the officers in your thoughts and your prayers. But this 23-year-old likely would have been able to continue on the road that he was on, racking up dozens more arrests without ever facing serious consequences for his crimes. But because he shot at two New York police officers, because he committed a crime that ends up on the front page of the papers, because he commits a crime that ends up leading the nightly news, now we're talking about this young man. 23 years old and 17 arrests. And I assume, by the way, that those are the arrests as an adult. I assume that his juvenile record was sealed. New York Daily News can say, well, you know what, we need more gun control laws. Clearly this shows the need for Congress to get serious, to pass a quote-unquote universal background check bill, which would be what? What's the punishment for violating that? Is it going to be any worse than the punishment for robbery, for instance? Again, the only reason why you think the answer for crimes like this are more gun control laws on the books is if you think the system is working. But in order for you to think that the system is working, you have to hear that this 23-year-old man had 17 arrests to his name without any serious consequences for any of those crimes. And you have to be okay with that. That has to be evidence for you that the system is working. But maybe you don't think the system is working when you hear stories like this. Maybe you think the answer is not another gun control law, but the answer is to figure out why, how somebody as a grown man can be arrested almost two dozen times over a five-year period and still be out on the streets to shoot at police officers. This 23-year-old suspect in the shootings of these two New York police officers, today's deal of the day. Our good guy of the day, from KMTV in Iowa. Now that the Iowa caucuses are over, all of the Iowa TV stations can get back to covering non-political stories. And maybe it was a slow day in Council Bluffs, but I'm glad they covered this story. It was earlier in the week, Council of Bluffs, Iowa, had some pretty significant snowfall. They had a snow emergency midweek. And when you have a snow emergency and you live in a city, that means, you know, you're not supposed to park along the snow emergency routes because they got to get the plows there. So you got to move your car. Not a big thing for most people unless you are elderly, you have some health problems, and in which case it might be a bigger thing. Council Bluffs police towed about 30 cars on Tuesday, but they also tried to let people know what was coming and what they needed to do. Officer Jackie Laurie talked with a woman named Dora Lee Sassman. Officer Laurie came over on Tuesday afternoon and was knocking on doors, asking people, you know, everything okay? You know, you've got an emergency, you got to move your car. And he ran across Dora Lee Sassman, who, when she heard that her car could be towed, said, "I can't afford that." She suffers from chronic medical conditions, KMTV says, and so Officer Laurie moved her car for her. Real simple. Not something that, generally speaking, would be newsworthy, but the woman in question, Dora Lee Sassman, she thought someone needed to know about this. So she started calling. And she ended up calling all the way up to the mayor's office and the Council Bluffs police chief, Tim Carmody, just to let them know that an officer had done a simple kindness. Didn't take him a lot of time. Took him a little bit of effort, but didn't take him a lot of time. But it meant all the world to her. Chief Carmody says, "Well, this is a partnership. This is a relationship with these citizens, and we want it to be as good as it can be." And thanks to the simple kindness of Officer Jackie Lowry, sounds like they are well on their way. So, Officer Lowry, thank you, sir, for being one of the many good guys out there. Now, when we come back after a quick break, we're going to talk about the increase in gun sales, the increase in concealed carry. Charles Cook of National Review joins us to crunch some of the numbers. Stick around. We'll be right back with much more NRA News Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, right after this.
Speaking with Juliana Crowder with A Girl and a Gun. Juliana, welcome back to NRA News. How are you?
I'm doing fabulous.
Tell folks, what is A Girl and a Gun?
A Girl and a Gun is an organization for women, and we get them out to the shooting range. We have activities for ladies who are brand new all the way through experienced shooters. So we offer kind of like a social club, but we also are being very serious about safety and training, and then also helping women reach certain goals with firearms that they might have.
Why did you start this?
It was really important for me to see more women out in the competitive shooting sports and also taking more responsibility for their personal safety. So I wanted to have kind of like a happy hour or a non-confrontational experience at the range.
Right.
So we just started hosting Girls Night Out and making it a social experience and then slowly introducing the more serious training aspect.
Well, whether it's shooting sports or hunting or anything, there's much more than just the aspect of picking up the gun. You're right. It's a social thing that involves friends, family, mentoring, whatever it involves, it's
right.
So important to make that work. Good. So just give us a flavor of some of the stuff you like to do.
So we like to go shoot IDPA and three gun. We have ladies going on hunts for the first time.
Cool.
We have ladies learning about archery.
All right, good.
We share experience about holsters, guns, different gear and equipment that might work better for certain body types.
A lot different for men and women.
And we're also sharing the emotional experience of being a firearms owner, because for some, it could be a traumatic transition from something that's happened in their life, and for others it's a very joyful experience of liberation and empowerment. So we really are offering something for everyone.
Awesome. How can people get more information about A Girl and a Gun?
They can find us at agirlandagun.org, and we're also on Facebook.
Juliana Crowder, A Girl and a Gun, thank you so much for being on NRA News. You're always there for us, but thank you for what you do. Thank you for your passion. You keep it up, and we'll talk to you soon.
Oh, thank you very much. Have a great day.
speaking with Mike Christensen with Pass It On Outdoor Mentors. Mike, welcome back to NRA News. You've got something neat going on for the new year, the 2016 Gun a Week drawing. What is it all about?
John, this is one of our big fundraisers for the year, beginning the first Wednesday in March. We're going to give away a gun every week for 52 weeks. At the end of those 52 weeks, everybody who didn't win a gun will go into a drawing. And then we also take all of the winners and put them in a drawing. So somebody is guaranteed to win two guns out of this drawing.
Two guns. That sounds like a good deal. So this is for Pass It On Outdoor Mentors. Let's tell folks what it is that you guys do.
John, we're working to give kids who don't have a chance to get outdoors that opportunity. We're taking kids who are served by organizations like Big Brothers and Big Sisters and other youth mentoring organizations, an opportunity to get out, learn to hunt and fish and shoot, and enjoy the great outdoors that we all know and love.
That is so awesome. So how do folks get involved in this drawing?
They can go to outdoormentors.org and click on the Gun a Week drawing link on the front page and get signed up right there.
That is so good. Before we run out of time, once again, it's a 2016 Gun a Week drawing. Tickets are available now. Start drawing first Wednesday in March. And Mike, I got about 30 seconds left. Tell folks why it's so important to get involved with an organization like yours. Why do you do what you do?
There are too many kids today who are never going to have a chance to go hunting and fishing unless those of us who love the outdoors step up and make that happen. And that's what outdoor mentoring is all about.
All right. Once again, it's the 2016 Gun a Week drawing. Tickets available now. How do folks get those tickets again, Mike?
Outdoormentors.org. Click on the link right there on the front page.
All right. So you're starting the drawing first Wednesday in March. Go there now and get information and find out more information about this great group, Pass It On Outdoor Mentors. Mike Christensen, thank you, sir, for what you do, and thank you for being on NRA News. You have a good one.
Welcome back to NRA News. Cam and Company, still to come on the program, Mr. Tony Katz will be with us right now. I want to welcome to the show our friend from National Review, Mr. Charles Cook. How you doing, Charles?
How you doing?
I am excellent. So more than 2.5 million background checks performed in January, a record for the month of January, according to FBI statistics. And according to anti-gunners, let's see, you probably accounted for what, 400,000 purchases, right?
Well, yes, I did buy 400,000 guns, but I did it with one background check.
Oh, that's true. That's right, because yeah, multiple firearms can be with one background check. So, But you went back a lot of times, right? I mean, you know, there is this belief. I don't even want to call it a belief. There is this stated belief that there are fewer and fewer gun owners in this country. Anti-gun advocates like to point to the General Social Survey, which shows a declining number of gun ownership, despite other polls like Pew and Gallup showing gun ownership fairly steady. They want to claim that there are fewer and fewer Americans owning firearms, but boy, these numbers make it really hard for them to make that case.
Well, they do, and we should review the numbers at the outset. The fact is that if you have 2.5 million background checks, I think 3.3 million last year, which was the
in one month last year.
Right. You probably have that many guns being sold. Now, it's slightly complicated in that you can buy more than one gun with a background check. And also that some of those background checks may be for concealed carry permits. You also have about a 1% attrition rate per year of the guns in supply. But if we take a conservative estimate from that information, and we presume that background checks pretty much equate to gun sales, then you're looking at adding 2.5 million guns on average per month over the last few years to the supply. And if you take the Washington Post higher-end estimate from 2013 that there were 360 million guns in the United States in private hands, then you're looking at about 400 million by the end of 2015. And if you presume that this rate's going to continue, in 5 years, there'll be 500 million guns in the United States in private hands. That's an extraordinary number. As to who's owning them, well, I understand the GSS information, and it shouldn't be dismissed out of hand. At the same time, the idea that we have seen this massive increase in gun ownership, or rather gun sold, and no increase in gun ownership. In fact, a decrease in gun ownership seems odd, and it seems to contradict the rest of the information we have. That being that there are an awful lot of first-time buyers. You ask any gun store employee, and he'll tell you that. There are an awful lot of women joining the shooting sports and joining the ranks of gun owners, and minorities as well, and young people. I personally think it's unlikely that the government survey is going to yield a reasonable response. If the government called me up and asked if I had any guns, I'd say no.
And I think, Charles, that you're likely not alone. Now, look, I mean, here's more anecdotal evidence. So we had our armed citizen story today, our hero of the day, and it was a fellow out in Sanger, California. He was a concealed carry holder, held a burglar in his home for police. Defensive gun use where the trigger was never pulled, like the vast majority of defensive gun uses. But sort of buried in this story at ABC 30, they say that the Fresno County Sheriff's Office says before the attacks in San Bernardino, it would take somebody about a month to get their concealed carry license. Now, with the amount of requests, the waiting period is 10 months, Charles, in Fresno County, California.
I can't imagine that those people are all existing gun owners or existing concealed carry permit holders. Clearly, we're seeing people applying for the first time. There is a change afoot. People have recognized that the right to keep and bear arms is not a vestige from a prior era. It's not an accident. It's not a guarantee of the militia that has been hijacked by gun nuts. It is an auxiliary right that is the necessary corollary to a fundamental and unalienable right, and that is of self-defense. I think people understand increasingly that in a society in which nobody is allowed to bear arms, not just guns, but arms in general, only the strong, only the prepared, only the rich, only those who are kept away from any danger will be safe. And people who aren't traditionally interested in guns, who may not share the politics of the average person who comes on this show, listens to this show, recognize, probably for the first time, that it's no good mouthing platitudes if there are people out there who want to do you harm. And I think that that's a good thing. You know, you and I and anyone else in our position believes that if you hurt somebody or wish to hurt somebody, you should be punished, and you should be punished severely. But that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about people defending themselves and their families. And I think it's a good thing for humanity and for individual rights in general that message is spreading.
Well, listen, I'm right there with you. And as a matter of fact, you know, yesterday, the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals, I don't know if you've had a chance to read the opinion yet, but they said in no certain terms, yes, this right of self-defense is real. It's a fundamental right. It includes things like defending yourself with an AR-15, with a 20-round magazine. The Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals said semi-automatic long guns, these are the quote-unquote assault weapons that Maryland is trying to ban, that these are commonly owned firearms used by law-abiding Americans for a variety of lawful purposes, and that the Maryland Firearms Safety Act needs to be considered under strict scrutiny. In other words, the highest level of judicial scrutiny needs to be applied to see if these laws are constitutional or whether or not they need to fall by the wayside.
Well, they did two extremely important things in that case, and I'm leaving aside the possibility that the circuit split will now cause the Supreme Court to step in.
Mm.
The first thing they did was they acknowledged that if a Ford F-150 is the most popular car in the country, which it is, and if an AR-15 is the most popular rifle in the country, which it is, then it is ridiculous to suggest that the Ford F-150 is in common use if you don't also suggest that the AR-15 is in common use, and that because the AR-15 is in common use, it's therefore protected under the standard laid out in Heller, which is the law of the land, as Barack Obama would say. The second thing they did, as you say, was to apply strict scrutiny. Now, that matters, because when it comes to questions of speech, when it comes to questions of, say, the establishment of religion, when it comes to 14th Amendment questions and equality under the law, the courts apply strict scrutiny. And they do that because it is laid out in the Constitution very clearly what the government can and can't do. Well, it is laid out in the Constitution very clearly what the government can and can't do in the realms of firearms as well. And far, far too often, courts have treated the Second Amendment as if it's a poor relation, as if it doesn't really count, as if it's a well, yes, but amendment. It's not. Strict scrutiny, of course, has to be applied. It's part of the Bill of Rights. And I hope that this will become more and more common until it is reflexive among judges and in the legal profession to treat the right to keep and bear arms seriously. The Fourth Circuit did yeoman's work yesterday, and I hope that it's built on at a higher level.
Did you have the opportunity to read the dissent at all?
I did read the dissent, yes.
I thought that was pretty awful. I mean, even as far as, I've read anti-gun opinions before, but the judge at one point, the dissenting judge at one point asserted that the quote-unquote assault weapons are responsible for most violent crime.
Which is factually false, of course.
It's yeah.
All rifles, not those that are arbitrarily termed assault rifles, all rifles account for about 2% of murders in the United States, half as many as hands and fists and elbows. As so-called assault rifles are so infrequently used in crimes that the FBI doesn't even keep statistics. But I wouldn't be surprised by that, Cameron. I'm sure you're not. If you read the dissent in the Highland Park case, you will have seen that the majority in that case, unfortunately, which prevailed, was garbage. If you read the dissent in Heller, which thankfully did not prevail, you will see formulations, to quote Scalia, that are worthy of the Mad Hatter. The anti-gun side, both legally and practically speaking, does not have a strong case. We should not expect to see strong arguments in its favor.
That's a very good point, Charles. Listen, I appreciate you coming on the program, sir. It's always a pleasure talking with you, and hope we get a chance to catch up in person again soon.
Absolutely. I will. I'll certainly see you at the convention in May, if not before.
All right. Well, we'll talk again soon. Charles Cook from National Review joining us here on NRA News, Cam and Company, talking again about the record number of background checks in January of this year. Now, Charles is correct that, the NICS system is accessed when a purchase is made at retail, but also is accessed when a background check is performed for your concealed carry license. So we do know, again, that more Americans are getting their concealed carry license in a not insubstantial amount, right? I think 6,000 in Minnesota in 1 month. But when you consider, we could try to crunch the numbers and what demographically that would look like. But if you're looking at, 50 states times 6,000 background checks on average per month, and that's a pretty good month for Minnesota, you're still not anywhere close to the 2.5 million background checks that were performed in January of 2016, that record number of background checks. Now, I think that, again, despite all protests to the contrary, what we are seeing, not on the evening news, not in the pages of our newspapers, not from anti-gun politicians, but what we are actually seeing on the ground in communities across this country are more Americans who are exercising the right to keep and bear arms, more Americans who are thinking about their right for the very first time. More Americans coming to the conclusion that perhaps not only do they want to be a gun owner, but they want to be a concealed carry holder. More Americans coming to the conclusion that after years of being a gun owner, now they want to be a concealed carry holder as well. But we are seeing this, again, in all parts of the country. Rural states, urban states, big cities, small towns. This is something that is really, truly happening all across America, and it is happening at the same exact time that anti-gun advocates and activists are telling anti-gun politicians, this is the perfect opportunity to be anti-gun. This is the election when you want to be publicly anti-gun right here, right now. Americans are demanding that you be anti-gun, and you'll win your election as long as you're anti-gun. Meanwhile, again, in the real world, Americans are not flooding their Congress critters' phone lines demanding more anti-gun laws. They're not showing up by the tens of thousands to protest gun shows. They're showing up by the tens of thousands to attend gun shows. We don't have thousands of Americans who have found this new commitment to quote-unquote gun safety. We have tens of thousands of Americans who in the past month decided that they actually wanted to become safer, more proficient with a firearm. So they went to a training course. They went to a range. Again, that's what's actually happening across the country, just so rarely reported by the anti-gun media. All right, we need to take a quick time out. When we return here on this edition of NRA News, Cam and Company, Mr. Tony Katz joins us. We've got to ask Tony how Iowa was. He was there over last weekend on into caucus day. We'll talk about some of the other big stories as well, kicking around the news this week. So stick around. We'll be right back with much more NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, right after this.
I'm speaking with David Agata and Ron Sasaki with AmericanSnipers.org. Gentlemen, welcome to NRA News.
Thanks. Thanks for having us.
Tell me, what is AmericanSnipers.org all about?
We're a nonprofit, totally volunteer. Nobody makes any money. But basically what we do is we raise money, we buy gear, and we send it to military snipers overseas to do the business that needs to be done.
And how did you start this?
In 2002-2003, we're basically police snipers from around the country. There's a big, I guess, the community's very tight, but there's a wide spread of us. And a couple of us were being deployed as reservists and National Guard as snipers. They were also police snipers, and they needed gear that they didn't have available. So we put that together, started this little project, raised a little bit of money, and then realized there was a big need. And that was 2003. We've since grown legs, and here we are 14 years later, still raising money, sending gear to snipers in country.
So, Ron, going from where you guys started in 2003 to now, what's the trip been like? How has it grown? What's happened?
Well, it's been quite an adventure for us, but a lot of the needs have not really changed. The sniper units only have so much money, so once that money runs out, the guys are doing without. So we're still providing things, mostly sniper-specific gear, like rangefinders, spotting scopes, rifle scopes, gun cleaning gear, binoculars, that kind of thing. And it's the type of gear, like Dave said, when guys are getting deployed, they would call back home and they're asking mom and dad, hey, can you pick me up a wind meter? Well, folks don't generally know where to get that kind of stuff, but we do. So that's why they come to us, and we're able to get them their specific gear that they need.
Speaking with David Agata and Ron Sasaki with AmericanSnipers.org. All right, so you guys start this. It's a no-brainer to me. It's a great idea and a great service you're all doing. What's the reaction rolling this out in the sniper community?
We have, when people know what we're doing, all they want to do is help. And where they can help us is we raise money. We sell swag. We sell coins and little trinkets. People give and donate. The manufacturers will donate, but for the most part, people hear about it and they go, that's awesome. I'm upset we have to do that, but yeah, we want to help them.
Yeah, and it's funny you mentioned that, David. Ron, what do you guys think about, and I don't want to get political, but what do you think about that? It's got to be frustrating to officers to know that sometimes they can't get the support they need to get the equipment that they need.
I don't think that's ever going to change. I think as long as we have a bureaucracy that has budgets and budgets get tight, we're not going to always be able to get the things we need. We know that as police officers. We know that as the military, there's priorities. And the bottom line is, as American citizens, we're going to support our military. And when people recognize that and we can broad stroke share that, they want to be part of that.
That's cool. Once again, speaking with David Agata and Ron Sasaki with AmericanSnipers.org. You know, there's a lot of folks who don't understand what it is, the mindset, the mentality, the life of a sniper, whether it's a military or police. Ron, what can you tell people about how can they understand best what you guys are, what you go through, you know, help get inside your head.
Well, it's just a very specialized thing that we do. It's something that people volunteer for, but you also have to have the right mindset and the determination and the professionalism to go through that. It's not for everybody, and not everybody gets to do it. But it's a very special thing, and guys who earn that spot, we try and help them out by doing what we do.
All right, it's a big sacrifice. Normally, military police, you're sacrificing.
Right, so give us an idea of some of the people that you've helped and who have benefited from AmericanSnipers.org.
Without naming names, it's been hundreds of guys in all different branches of the service. So we're at events like this. We get approached by people and said, hey, in 2004, you sent us a bunch of gear. You really helped us out. We hear from parents. So that's what we get out of it. That's what we find fulfilling.
Gentlemen, I bet you that never gets old either, right?
No,
not at all.
Not at all. Not at all. And then some of the gear that we get or we get donated, we get to give that back to the manufacturers. We had a company that donated some knives.
Tell folks how they get more information about AmericanSnipers.org.
Well, you can go to our website at www.AmericanSnipers.org, and that's where they can donate. We always have gun raffles going on constantly of some pretty high-end guns that we get donated to us.
David, Ron, thanks for what you do, and thanks for being part of NRA News.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, sir.
Welcome back. Thanks so much for being a part of this edition of NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by our friends at Nosler. All right. 93.1 on your radio dial, number one in your hearts, at least if you live in Indianapolis, Indiana. And if you're listening to this program, he's probably top five. Tony Katz, host of Tony Katz in the Morning News on WIBC in Indy. How are you, sir?
Who's in the top five with me?
Let's see. Probably got to throw Kurt Schlichter up there. I think the audience
whole list is ridiculous
quite
already.
Fond of Kurt. I'm not saying I'm not saying where you all are in the top five. We had Charles Cook with us. He might be there.
Not American doesn't count.
Sheriff David Clark of Milwaukee County, Wisconsin.
Fine, upstanding young man, but ruled out because he lives in Wisconsin. Next.
Ed Morrissey of Hot Air.
Ed Morrissey owes me $20. Next.
Oh, well, he does have a book coming out, so hopefully it'll be a huge runaway success.
Ed Morrissey has a book coming out?
He does, yes. It's called Going Red.
Oh, gosh, because he's been for years flirting with a book idea about manscaping.
I thought this was Ed coming out as a full-fledged commie, but no. It's not. It's about
the... Because Going Red could also be a book about manscaping.
I suppose it could, yes, if you have a ginger beard like I do. But let's not go there, Tony. I want to find out about your trip with Fingers Malloy, your road trip to Iowa.
Speaking of manscaping.
Speaking of manscaping, exactly. Did he have the fresh mohawk for the trip to Iowa?
Oh, yeah. Oh, Fingers Malloy was ready to go, ready to play. You should talk to him about it. He was fantastic, and it was, listen, it's not every day I get to drive from Indianapolis to Iowa, and after driving there, I know why. But to be on the ground and to experience what the press is going through in covering people like Trump, to understand what the people of Iowa go through in dealing with the deluge of insanity that is the Iowa caucuses. It's 24/7 on your television. It's 24/7 on your radio and 24/7 on your phones. The robocalls go on forever. You cannot go shopping, without a candidate being there trying to shake your hand and tell you what kind of granola to buy. And by the way, that's the trick because they're telling you what kind of granola to buy. You're talking to the wrong candidate. it's an experience and it's one that honestly people should engage in. And I know this because not only having done it a few times now, I ran into, and Fingers Malloy and I ran into people who were literally taking their vacation to come to Iowa to be where the candidates are and to meet them and to hear them.
Wow. I mean,
it's become that kind of thing. It's become celebrity in a way. Here's this chance. Iowa and New Hampshire offer the two greatest chances in America for you to sit down with a candidate. Once you get past New Hampshire, not going to happen. The states just aren't built for that kind of retail intensity politics. But in Iowa, you can be nose to nose with Carly Fiorina or with Jeb Bush, or although I don't know why you want to be nose to nose with a guy who's not going to be in the race for another hour. Please clap. Please. No, that wasn't funny. Please. I put my heart and soul into that. Come on. I want to be president. Come on. That's basically what you can see if you show up to Iowa. Jeb Bush begging. It's really a tremendous experience, and everyone should try it.
So do you think, because it's interesting, we've talked a lot about the early primaries in Iowa and New Hampshire and the attention that is paid there. And I'm sure that there are some states and folks living in other states who say, why should this happen to Iowa and New Hampshire every cycle? Why can't we be the first in the nation? Do you get the sense that there is both a pride among Iowans that they're first in the nation, that they get this sort of retail politics, but also that there is a sense of relief when it's over?
Well, let me go back to the original part of that question, which is, should they be first in the nation, and other states maybe wonder whether they should have it or not. There's the old adage is, be careful what you wish for, because you really want this nonstop cavalcade, part clown show, part democracy in action happening in your backyard every single day. Do Iowans have a pride in it? Yeah, I think that's obvious and that's true. And if you were to take a look at what Iowa did in just the top three vote getters in Cruz, Trump, Rubio, maybe they were able to take this field and say, okay, here's what America has told us. Here are the types of Republicans you can get, and then there's Donald Trump, right? Here it is, folks. And we gave it to you in mass measures. Not only we spread the field, we clumped it all together. Now you figure out the rest. Maybe they did us a favor, maybe not. I don't know. New Hampshire, I think they take a pride in it as well. I don't think there's any doubt. I think that when you live in a place like Indiana, as I do, and you realize that your primary is May 3rd, well, by May 3rd, it's all over. And I can't stand the system that says other states get to decide the candidate for me. I'd love to see Indiana move up. But you move up and you lose delegates and you get fined and there's punishments. And I think you got to try. I think you got to try and you got to strong arm the RNC to the best of your ability and be a player in this. Because I think that if the question is, would you rather have it or not, I think that the heartache is worth it. Especially if you're the kind of society that wants to have a stake. I would actually like that for Indiana. I'd like to see us move up quite a bit. Not that we ever will, not that we can, and I haven't really explored deeply how that would work. But if the question is, do you really want it? I think so, because I think it's, to be a part of that of the formulation, I think is worth it.
It's interesting. I mean, I've thought about this as well in Virginia, because we are part of the SEC primary. So we'll go to the polls early enough that I think our vote is going to matter. I don't think anything's going to be settled by March the 1st.
Super Tuesday, right?
Yeah. But we're one of, I don't know how many states, more than a dozen states voting on March the 1st. As you say, when you get to that point, we might have a couple of candidates come to Virginia at some point between March the 1st, but the candidates are trying to cover so much ground. They can never compete on the ground personally in these states. This is when you start seeing the television ads become much more important. The ground game among volunteers becomes much more important. You're right. You just can't engage in that sort of retail politics. But I wonder, too, how do you do this? How do you get away from the system that we have now, and what do you want to move towards? Do you want to move towards like a mini Super Tuesday, where maybe we start with, four states or six states, and then 2 weeks later we've got more states voting? I'm not sure how you set up a system that everybody's going to be happy with.
I don't know how you set up a system that everyone's going to be happy with either, but I'm not looking to make everybody happy.
You're looking to make you happy.
I only said in reference to Indiana, where I live, I'd love to see them move up. Maybe other states are absolutely fine where they are. Maybe other states have reasons for not wanting to be that early in the process. Maybe the Republican Party needs to say, okay, time for a shakeup. Iowa, it's no longer you. Maybe there's a moment for that. Remember, it wasn't always, was it always Iowa first in the nation? Or is that something that was really an advent of the 70s, I thought? So I don't have a dog in the fight in terms of, oh, here's how we have to change the whole system, because I don't know if we have to change the whole system. What I am willing to say, and what I believe, is that I'd love to see some other players in there. The idea of breaking up Super Tuesday is an interesting one to me. Maybe there's a purpose to it, because one of the things that Super Tuesday can prove is the strength of ground game and the ability to coordinate over a multi-state field. Maybe that's a skill set that we should take a look at our candidates, see what they can do, and then be able to move forward from there, get out the vote efforts and what have you. That's the big story of New Hampshire, right?
Mm-hmm.
The big story of New Hampshire is that Donald Trump spent $1.2 million on hats in Iowa and spent less money than that on voter data. So what's his ground game in New Hampshire? You've got governors Bush, Kasich, and Christie, who all have far superior ground games to Donald Trump in New Hampshire, yet Donald Trump is up by 20 points over Marco Rubio. So what is it that these things are teaching us and telling us? And I think all of it is important, and maybe part of it is there's a new way to do this. Maybe there's a better way to do this for candidates and maybe for states. And if I were to take that lesson from Iowa, maybe not, because Donald Trump was interested in big rallies and big events and hats, and he came in second.
All right. Now, and I realize you were only in Iowa for a couple of days, so I understand the limitations. You weren't, you know, driving all throughout the state, but we did see, it looks like anyway, a more turnout in the Republican caucus than in the Democratic caucus. That'd be the first time that that's happened in Iowa. And we know that there were a lot more Republicans turning out to caucus in 2016.
180,000 was the number of caucus goers for Republicans in Iowa. It was 4 years before, the number was 120,000.
Mm-hmm. So this is my
massive
question.
By any scale, that's massive. That's Trump effect, and that could just be a tiring of what and a disgust of what Obama's done to the country.
Well, okay, so this was going to be my question. As you were on the ground, did you get that sense, because you were there in the weekend before the caucus, did you get the sense that there was more excitement or energy on the Republican side, just based on who you're talking to, the yard signs, the looking around at what life looked like in Iowa the weekend before the caucus?
I can honestly say that I never asked the question and never had the statement put to me, because it was a fait accompli. It was a given you were going to vote in the caucus. And so maybe that in and of itself is the answer. No one ever said, wow, we're really feeling the excitement for this year's caucus. No, you had an excitement for a candidate. That definitely happened. No one I spoke to anywhere. I spoke to people on the streets. I spoke to a 20-year-old girl at a local coffee shop who said she was going to caucus for Marco Rubio. Now, it's of note because it was the only time that whole week or all the time I was there that I heard anybody mention Marco Rubio's name. On the ground, you didn't see him. You didn't hear him, especially in that Des Moines, West Des Moines area. I didn't hear anything of Marco Rubio. But when we talked to people off the record who knew the numbers, who did lots of polling or looking at polling data, they all said Marco was going through a tremendous rise, and he was something to watch. The national polls had him at 15% before that debate before Iowa and 15% afterward. Yet everybody who knew something about the inside numbers said it was going up. On the ground, though, you didn't hear anything. So it was a pretty interesting kind of thing to hear that a 20-year-old girl is or a 20-year-old guy, heck, a 20-year-old anything, a 20-year-old Sue is voting for Marco Rubio. And it just goes to that bigger point of it wasn't a question of if, it was a question of who.
Again, Tony Katz, our guest here. You can listen to him on WIBC in Indianapolis, Indiana. Tony, unfortunately, we are almost out of time, but you are going to be at home this weekend. Got any big plans?
There's a Super Bowl to watch here in Indianapolis. We're rooting for Peyton Manning. We'd like to see him be 2-2 in Super Bowls. We'd like to see him throw well and pick apart a Panthers defense. That is not an easy thing to do. And I don't know if Cam Newton has ever gone against a defense like what Denver has and take Von Miller directly in the face. So I'm looking forward to enjoying the game with do-it-yourself nachos.
Ah, all right. Well, listen, I appreciate you coming on the program. Good luck to Peyton Manning. I might be pulling for the guy named Cam, but I wouldn't be sad to see Peyton Manning win another one.
Everything about you makes me sad.
Love you, buddy. Have a good weekend. We'll talk to you soon.
Later.
All right, Tony Katz, you can hear him again weekday mornings on WIBC-FM in Indianapolis, Indiana. And unfortunately, that is about all the time that we have for you on this edition of NRA News Cam and Company. So let me spend the last few moments that we have here together reminding you again that on Monday and Tuesday of next week, we're going to be in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, broadcasting live from the Great American Outdoor Show at the Pennsylvania Farm Show Complex. We'll be broadcasting again live 2 to 5 Eastern Monday and Tuesday. I'll actually be up there starting tomorrow. The show gets underway February the 6th there in Harrisburg, runs through February 14th. You've got 9 days to attend. You probably want at least one or two. I mean, you can sprint through in one day maybe, but I'd have 2 days to spend at the Great American Outdoor Show there in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. If you are going to be there over the opening weekend, stop by the NRA News booth and say hello. We're going to be talking with a lot of our friends next week on the program, and really over the course of those 9 days in Harrisburg, all of your favorite outdoor stars and personalities are going to be there at some point over the 9 days. Best bet is to look at the website for the Great American Outdoor Show. It is greatamericanoutdoorshow.org. They have a list of events. They have information on exhibitors. They can even help you find a hotel if you're interested in heading up to Harrisburg for a day or two. Thank you so much for being a part of this edition of NRA News, Cam and Company. Have yourself a fantastic weekend. We'll talk to you again Monday, live 2 p.m. Eastern at NRAnews.com, midnight Eastern, SiriusXM Patriot 125, and on demand all the time on iHeartRadio and on the new NRA News Roku app.